The United States has an insatiable appetite for conflict. And since going into Korea in the 1950s, it's been at war with someone or other in some corner of the globe non-stop right up to the present day. This drive is now led by the weapons manufacturers themselves. It is a highly dangerous precedent. I call it war corporatism. It is the door of a new fascism being pushed open. And don't be fooled, not all fascism looks like Adolf Hitler.
This week in Radical History for the week starting February 2nd.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
On this day, February 2nd in 1848, a treaty was signed which ceded even more of Mexico to the U.S. Known as the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, named after the chapel and the town in which it was signed, Mexico ceded nearly 55% of its total land area and the people who lived on that land to the United States for a mere $15 million. The newly annexed area included all of California, Nevada, and Utah, and Colorado, most of Arizona, and much of New Mexico, and even a portion of Wyoming. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Also on February 2nd, 1905, Ayn Rand lives. Right-wing dandy, author of The Fountainhead and the philosophy exploiting greed and individual acts without consciousness. She'd later be reincarnated as Ann Coulter. Okay, I'm really not sure about that part. Maybe it was Rush Limbaugh or Dick Cheney. Also on February 2nd, 1931, as the Depression worsens, public officials across the Southwest decide it would be cheaper to send legal residents back to Mexico than to carry them on the welfare rolls. During the decade's first 4 years, well over 400,000 Mexican-Americans, many U.S. citizens living here as long as 40 years, are repatriated. Some families, as a result, are split because the father or mother or both would be considered alien. Also on February 2nd, 1951, the first 4 of 7 blacks convicted of raping a Martinsville, Virginia white woman are executed. By some odd anomaly, to this date only one white has ever been executed for raping in Virginia's glorious history. Lastly, on this date in 1972 in Ireland, 3 days after 13 unarmed civilian rights demonstrators were shot to death by British paratroopers in Northern Ireland, outraged Irish citizens burned down the British embassy in Dublin. This week in Radical History for February 3rd, 1892 in Argentina, U.S. Marines land in Buenos Aires to protect American interests. Also on February 3rd, 1909, French philosopher, syndicalist Simone Weil lives. Her passionate need to share with the suffering of others led her to fight with the anarchists in the Spanish Revolution. Writers as diverse as T.S. Eliot and Albert Camus declare her one of our century's foremost thinkers. Quote, "As I worked in the factory, the affliction of others entered into my flesh and my soul. There I received forever the mark of a slave, like the branding of a red-hot iron which the Romans put on the forehead of their most despised slaves. Since then I have always regarded myself as a slave." Simone Weil. Another outstanding woman in 1910, Mary Harris Mother Jones addresses Milwaukee brewery workers. Mother Jones spent 2 months working alongside women bottle washers in one of the breweries. Her report of the working conditions went like this. "Condemned to slave daily in the washroom in wet shoes and wet clothes, surrounded with foul-mouthed, brutal foremen, the poor girls worked in the vile smell of sour beer, lifting cases of empties and full bottles weighing from 100 to 115 pounds in their wet shoes and rags, for they could not buy clothes on the pittance doled out to them. Rheumatism was one of the many chronic ailments and is closely followed by consumption." Mother Jones. Also on February 3rd, 1912, 32,000 Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The Bread and Roses strike began last month and lasts for over 9 weeks. Despite collusion by the government and mill owners and their hired goons, strikers would not waver, even when 18-year-old Syrian worker John Ramey was killed, and another woman and her 2 sisters were arrested and dragged from their beds in the middle of the night. An Italian woman would suggest, "Tomorrow morning, men no go to picket line. All men, boys stay home, sleep. Only woman, girl on picket line tomorrow morning. Soldier and policeman will not beat girl woman. You see, I got big belly. She too got big belly. Policeman not beat us." The next morning, the women were out in full force, only to be beaten so badly that Italian women who spoke at the meeting and another pregnant striker lose their babies and almost die. Lastly, on this date, in 1964, 464,000 students, that's about 45% of the entire student population, boycott NYC schools to protest segregation. This week in radical history for February 4th, 1899 in the Philippines, a U.S. sentry shoots Filipino soldier, sparking a revolt against U.S. occupation. The islands become a U.S. colony following the Spanish-American War. The most barbaric forms of torture and interrogation, as well as scorched-earth military tactics and brutal reconcentration of civilians, were used. Filipino historians estimate that more than 300,000 Filipinos, mostly civilians, perish as a result of the American genocidal policies. Also on February 4, 1956, white students riot at the University of Alabama against court-ordered admission of the first black student. Also on that date in 1972, Senator Strom Thurmond asks Attorney General John Mitchell to deport John Lennon as an undesirable alien. Lastly, on February 4, 1985, 20 countries, but not the U.S. under the Ronald Reagan regime, sign a UN treaty outlawing torture. And we saw after 9/11 how much torture is in vogue in America. This week in radical history for February 5, 1631 in the New World, Roger William, pioneer of religious tolerance, arrives in North America. Hated by the Fundies, in 1647, he'll help establish a colony on Rhode Island, and the liberty of consciousness was proclaimed. The area had briefly become a safe haven for people who were persecuted for their beliefs, like the Quakers or the Jews, and for others who want to follow their consciousness of peace and safety. On May 18, 1652, Rhode Island would pass the first law in North America making slavery illegal. Also on February 5, 1923 in Italy, more mass arrests of socialists, anarchists, and communists occur. Also on that date in 1937, in an attempt to issue rulings favorable to his administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt requests authority to enlarge and, quote, pack, unquote, the Supreme Court. Also on February 5, 1993, Anthony Summers, a biographer of J. Edgar Hoover, says that he was a homosexual and blackmailed by the mafia for it. Lastly on this date in 2003, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell presents the U.S. evidence against Iraq to the U.N. Security Council. Most pieces of evidence turn out to be fabricated and a pack of lies. This is not the first time Powell rolled over for his president. As then first lieutenant in Vietnam, Powell was the initial investigating officer on the My Lai massacre and started the cover-up. This week in radical history for February 6, 1864, gay individual anarchist, novelist, poet John Henry Mackay lives. Quote six lines of his, I give thee to the future thine secure. When each at least unto himself shall waken, comes it in sunshine, in the tempest thrill. I cannot tell, but it the earth shall see. I am an anarchist, wherefore I will not rule, and also ruled I will not be. Also on the state in 1943, the U.S. orders 110,000 Japanese Americans imprisoned in internment camps and to answer loyalty question surveys. Question number 27 asks draft age men, are you willing to serve in the United States forces in a combat duty wherever ordered? Also on this date in 1950, Republicans adapt the 1950 slogan, quote, liberty against socialism, unquote. Now, a whole 59 years later, they're still fighting this ancient fight.
Why would I want him to succeed? Go back. Look, he's my president. If he gets nationalized health care, I mean, it's over, Sean. That's the end of America as we have known it. Why would I want that to succeed? So I shamelessly say no. I want him to fail.
Nice slogan. Two more items for February 6, 1976 in Canada. Native American activist Leonard Peltier is captured on the basis of fictitious affidavits generated by the FBI. Federal prosecutors later admit they didn't have a clue who committed the crime they convicted Peltier for. The FBI is often fondly referred to, because of its criminal conduct in cases like this, as the Federal Bureau of Fabrication. Lastly, talking about weapons of mass destruction dealers, on this date in 1996, the government admits that to this date it has shipped plutonium to 39 countries over the last 59 years, including Israel, South Africa, Iran, and Iraq. So what now? Do we invade ourselves? This week in radical history for February 7th, 1885. Germany's August Reinsdorf is executed by decapitation in Berlin. An anarchist and close friend of Johann Most, he is implicated in attempts on the life of Kaiser Wilhelm and his merry band of princes. Reinsdorf's last parting words were, I have nothing to repent, only that the attempt failed. If I had 10 heads, I would offer them with joy and lay them on the block for the good cause. Lastly, in a state in 1968, after America and South Vietnamese air and artillery strikes level the city of Ben Tri, South Vietnam, population of 50,000, a U.S. Army major explains that, quote, it became necessary to destroy the town to save it, unquote.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace.
Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
This Week in Radical History for February 8, 1851, American feminist writer Kate Choplin lives. Also on this date in 1887, President Cleveland signs the Dawes Land Allotment Act, dissolving Indian tribes as legal entities. It distributes territories held in common by American Indian nations to individual families. Each family will get up to 160 acres. The act ultimately results in a loss of tens of millions of acres of treaty land, driving a nail in the coffin of tribal culture. The congressional committee that proposed the law said it had several goals. The commune shall give way to the dignity and rights of American citizens. The heathen idol shall give place to the Christian altars, and the tribal organization shall be broken up and the individuality of Indian encouraged and developed, and the lands necessary reserved for them open to the pioneer, so that intelligence and thrift may find lodging there. Also on February 8, 1921 in Russia, the anarchist prince Milton Peter Potemkin dies. Lenin offers a state funeral and burial in the Kremlin Wall, which was refused by his family and comrades. Lastly, in 1988, a panel of international historians issue a report finding that Austrian Kurt Waldheim knew of war crimes committed by his World War II units and that he concealed and misrepresented his service during the war. He, of course, would later be rewarded as the Secretary General of the United Nations. Why not? We got a former Nazi pope. Why not this? That's it for this week in Radical History, produced at the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration for this segment came from the Slingshot Organizer, and a lot of radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. This week's ending song is dedicated to Kitty Cutthroat, the most rad person I know. So until next week's edition, a reminder that I'm always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Tough guy, huh?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a portion of an interview with the Electronic Intifada's founder, Ali Abu Nima, which was conducted on Al Jazeera English on December 26th of this past year. It concerns Abu Nima's response to the UN Security Council's resolution condemning the continuing illegal development of settlements on occupied Palestinian land. You will remember that the United States unexpectedly abstained on the vote, much to the consternation of Netanyahu. Here is Ali Abu Nima's response to that vote.
The Israeli government is claiming the UN vote was the result of a plot masterminded by the Obama administration. They say they'll hand over the proof to Donald Trump when he takes office and leave it up to him whether to share it with the public. The U.S. abstained from the vote, and the White House is denying any involvement in the drafting or wording of the resolution. Israel has also suspended working relations with the 12 countries that voted in favor of the resolution. That will mean much more limited diplomatic contact in the future. Ali Abu Nima is director of the Electronic Intifada and the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. He joins me via Skype from Chicago, and we appreciate your time. So the response, the fallout from Israel has been swift. It has been harsh, and they're indicating that it's not about to end anytime soon. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's ridiculous for this tiny little country that is really rather insignificant and depends on the charity, the diplomatic, economic, and military charity of the United States for its existence and for its occupation, to essentially be threatening sanctions against the likes of China and France and Ukraine and other countries. And really, this lashing out shows both the isolation of Israel in the world, the growing isolation because of its insistence on continuing to occupy and colonize Palestinian land. And I think it also shows how used Israel has become to enjoying total impunity. So this resolution came as a shock to Israel because Israel got so used to being indulged and coddled by all of these countries for much too long.
This vote so far seems largely symbolic, with the exception of the real actions that Israel is taking. But what practical effect or impact is this going to have on the life of daily Palestinians?
You're right. This resolution is words on paper unless there are real actions put behind it. The resolution itself doesn't threaten any specific sanctions against Israel. And in fact, all of these countries, or most of them anyway, particularly the European countries and the U.S., have said they oppose taking any action against Israel. Let's remember that the Obama administration, which is being castigated and spat at by Israel, just a few months ago signed the biggest military aid package from any one country to another in the history of humanity, which was $38 billion of unconditional military aid to Israel over the next decade. And so, you know, what I think Israel fears is that this resolution will give impetus to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, which is growing in effect and growing in popularity around the world. And that will eventually put pressure on governments like France and the UK that have been so complicit in Israel's occupation. It will increase the public pressure on them to really start ramping up sanctions against Israel.
What do you expect will happen under a new Donald Trump administration come January 20th?
If his appointment of these extremists like David Friedman as ambassador to Israel is an indication, then we can expect Trump to build on Barack Obama's considerable pro-Israel record. And really, put the United States in a camp of one. I think what the Security Council vote showed is that the world understands that Israel's actions, its occupation, its violations of Palestinian rights are not tenable, are destabilizing not just the region, but causing instability across the world. And I think the dilemma for Israel is that Israel is wholly dependent on the United States. And what we're seeing in the United States is a fracturing of the traditional bipartisan pro-Israel consensus. I think that this resolution and really what's been happening over the past couple of years in the U.S. has turned support for Israel into a bipartisan issue and increasingly into a niche concern of the American far right, particularly the political Christianist far right in the United States, who are even more pro-Israel than many American Jews. So I think on the whole, Israel is worried because the long run, the story is a weakening of support for Israel in the United States, even though Trump will be more pro-Israel in the short run, okay, and the increasing isolation of Israel globally.
Mr. Ali Abu Nima, Director of the Electronic Intifada, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Ali Abu Nima speaking on Al Jazeera English concerning the UN vote condemning the continuing Israeli development of settlements on occupied Palestinian land. This week in Mondo Weiss, Philip Weiss wrote a very interesting article concerning the double standard applied by many Jewish organizations when it comes to dealing with the refugees flooding out of the Middle East compared to Israel's handling of the Palestinian refugee crisis. He writes, "Over the past few days, a great number of Jewish groups have taken righteous stances against Donald Trump's executive order borrowing immigration from seven mostly Muslim nations and halting the refugee program. But when it comes to Israel, these same groups support the rejection of Palestinian refugees' demands because they would threaten the Jewish nature of the state. The contradiction highlights an uncomfortable truth. The degree to which discriminatory policies of the Jewish state are actually congruent with Trump's American nationalism. The liberal Zionist group, J Street, is circulating a petition against Trump titled, Stand Up for Refugees. Fight for America's moral standing in the world. Keep this nation open to refugees. J Street has heightened the plight of Syrian refugees. But when it comes to the Palestinian demand for the return of the 750,000 refugees created by the establishment of Israel in 1948 or their descendants, J Street sounds a lot like the American nationalist Steve Bannon, who was at Trump's elbow. J Street asks and answers the following. Palestinians are constantly invoking the right of return, which would flood Israel with refugees and undermine its homeland for the Jewish people. How can we reach a peace agreement when they continue to make that demand? No two-state agreement will include the full return of Palestinian refugees into Israel. Instead, the issue will be resolved by steps outlined in past peace proposals, which have offered Palestinian refugees citizenship in a future state of Palestine. Former negotiators believe it is most likely that Israel will offer monetary compensation and the symbolic acceptance of some refugees into Israel. Americans for Peace Now has also urged resistance against Trump's refugee order, but it too has been dismissive of Palestinian refugee claims inside Israel, saying that this would end the Jewish state. Demands that the principle of refugees' return be implemented inside Israel are tantamount to a demand that Israel cease to exist as a Jewish state. A solution will have to respect both the sensitivities of the Palestinian refugees and Israel's sovereign right to determine who may live within its borders. This is the right approach, and it is guided by moral, political, and strategic concerns. This week, 18 Jewish institutions and groups in Boston came out with a very strong statement against the Trump order. "We reject any effort to shut our nation's doors on the most vulnerable," they wrote. "We must not close our doors." In response to the executive orders this past week on immigration and separately regarding refugees, we, the undersigned Boston Jewish organizations, philanthropic, civic, and human service organizations, come together to say that these actions, which are causing anxiety, pain, and anguish throughout the immigrant communities and our nation, are unjust. We stand together on the side of empathy and religious tolerance, and we urge the administration to open the gates of compassion to those seeking safety, regardless of their faith or country of origin. But virtually every member of that coalition that is concerned about religious tolerance takes a hard stance against Palestinian refugees because they would threaten the Jewishness of Israel. Many of these groups even deny the existence of the Nakba, or Palestinian catastrophe, Israel's expulsion of Palestinians to make way for a majority Jewish state. Here, for instance, is the Jewish Community Relations Council's hard-hearted position. "Israel didn't expel the refugees. They fled. We're not responsible for their suffering, let alone their property." Israel is not responsible for the creation of the refugee problem or for perpetuating it. To accept responsibility would have far-reaching implications. One, it would encourage the arrival of millions of Palestinian refugees in the state of Israel, changing the demographics of the country in such a way as to effectively end the existence of the independent Jewish state. Two, it would be used as a basis for claims against Israel for compensation for loss of property and for 55 years of suffering. The American Jewish Committee takes a similar view of the Palestinian refugees, saying they are used to threaten Israel with destruction through exercise of the right of return, whereby the millions of refugees would inundate the state and erase its Jewish identity. But compare that language to the language of the AJC signed on to in the Boston statement against Trump. The approach to addressing these issues that was announced this past week is rooted in a rhetoric of fear and demonization and a policy that treats human beings around the world, including endangered refugees, many of whom are children who are suffering in devastating conditions, as an enforcement problem. The uncomfortable parallel between Trump's position on refugees and Israel's highlights the fact that both serve nationalist movements. It is no wonder that Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are already best friends, with Netanyahu tweeting in favor of the immigration policy. And the news site Breitbart that employed Steve Bannon and provided a platform for alt-right views that lifted Trump was founded by a right-wing Zionist out of a devotion to Israel. For liberal and centrist Zionists, the overlap is more touchy. These groups have helped champion many progressive campaigns in the United States, leading to rights and freedoms we hold dear. They like to describe Israel as a Jewish democracy, and they have for some years worked against Benjamin Netanyahu. But the fine print on that Jewish democracy can prove to be a bit embarrassing, as it is in the case of refugees. Jeff Klein makes a similar observation in a letter to the Globe about the letter from 18 Jewish organizations. The Globe reports today that Jewish communal organizations are opposing President Trump's executive order on refugees and immigrants. That's a good thing. Unfortunately, these same groups are also promoting Massachusetts legislation, SD922 and HD779, that would punish critics of Israel who advocate pressure on that country as to live up to its human rights obligations, including on refugees. That was an article written by Philip Weiss in Mondo Weiss. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, an interview of journalist and author Max Blumenthal, conducted on Telesure by Abby Martin. Like many of our broadcasts, we found this on YouTube. And like most of Blumenthal's presentations, it is loaded with personal observations and analysis from the ground, from Israel and the West Bank, and in this case also Gaza, where he was during the last Israeli bombardment of that region in 2014. This interview on YouTube takes place as you witness video outtakes of Israel's subjugation of the Palestinian people. At times you will hear unidentified voices of people in those videos, including political leaders, even Netanyahu. But although as a radio audience listening to a YouTube presentation, you cannot see the images, the narration is easy to follow. So here is Abby Martin interviewing Max Blumenthal in a presentation called Max Blumenthal, Palestine's Rebellion, Israel's Fascism.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who have grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they've seen very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier, They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So, for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bute outside Ramallah, there are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers. Around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv and Haifa and all of the cities inside Israel's interior where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa with knives or with rocks or whatever they have, they're reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East, and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah under the thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultra-nationalists. They built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. And you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been, traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out. And the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began, when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
It has been another relentless day for the medics here as casualties continue to pour in. Tragically, many of those are children.
Naima is just 2.5 years old. She was caught in a missile attack from an F-16. She has a broken nose and a fractured skull. She hasn't spoken a word.
We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
Doctors at the hospital here were unable to save Shahid.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground and you outlined some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shajaiya, which was you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map by Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes. And speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman, in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off, and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves, interviewing the Rujela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair, and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real-life horror film, and this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there. Most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation? How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected in a surprise to a lot of Americans after Operation Protective Edge. You have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72 to 80%, are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans, and for the first time you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
The hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Allah, yalla, yalla, yalla.
It was reported on by international news, and the family, it really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead And that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers, Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested. And the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shuja'iya. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shuja'iya and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the U.S. military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shuja'iya was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that you don't hit and run, you stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East, air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support because you'll kill them. The Israeli military found it, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th. I might be getting the date wrong. They decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shuja'iya, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. They managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Daif stated clearly that we're attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, you know, Fatawi, you know, Fatah supporting people in Ramallah for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends feel and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos, giving the Israeli military a bloody nose and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance there. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law. And members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. You know, why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against, you know, 7.62 millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs, and that Israel had a shoot-to-cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation, which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill. They're more likely to cripple. They shatter bones. They often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. Standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinian, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can, because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed. entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing right. Israeli government, that it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. You know, I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for, you know, a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's, you know, she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society. You just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the State of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens. And 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within, that those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here because it's Washington and the U.S. government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
That was an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal, conducted by Abby Martin on Telesure. The YouTube video from which the interview was extracted ended with a video of an Israeli military tank rolling into the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Over a loudspeaker system, an Israeli soldier shouts the following, which is translated from the Arabic. People of Aida camp, we are the occupational army. You throw stones, and we will hit you with gas until you die. The children, the youth, the old people, you will die. We won't leave any of you alive. We have arrested one of you. He is with us now. We took him from his home, and we will slaughter and kill him while you watch if you keep throwing stones. Go home, or we will gas you until you die. Your children, your families, everyone, we will kill you. Listen to me. All of you go home. It's better for you. The video ends with the sound of a rifle shot. Just think for a minute what it would be like for your children, our children, to hear such threats almost daily from a heavily armed military vehicle rolling down our streets. It is this constant threat of bodily injury and family disruption which has led to generations of traumatized children. The occupation continues to extract a terrible price on the youth and families of Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
This week, Sven Hughes, former psychological warfare officer in the British Army, now working in strategic communications, I'd imagine for quite a lot more money, talks about fake news. Also Sue Jones, her sideways section this week is on helium. And we speak to James Grossviner, he's the editor of the Rochdale Herald. It's a satirical spoof site where he tries to counter some of the right-wing propaganda. Dialects produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. And I'll repeat all the contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Sven Hughes, and I'm the founder of two companies, one called Verbalization and the other one called Global Influence. And we are consultancies for the private sector and also the public sector to help with strategic communications and effectively communicating with integrity.
So where did you get your training?
My background is twofold. I was previously a reservist in the British military in something called psychological operations. But I was also, I've worked for 20-something years in the marketing industry as well.
So what is this term strategic communications? It sounds to me a bit like PR on steroids.
Essentially, any brand, whether or not that's a private sector brand or a government initiative, will need to communicate what it's doing to the public and to the people, whatever the audience is. And so strategic communications is essentially working with a client, if that's a private sector client or a public sector client, to achieve their short-term ambitions. Maybe that's to sell more product, a tactical ambition to sell more product or to increase the amount of people who are washing their hands so as to stop, you know, tummy upsets or something like that, if it's for a government initiative. And also, though, to also communicate their overall brand equity beyond just the tactical purpose of the communication.
It sounds to me a bit like advertising dressed up as news.
No, it's not. No, advertising is you know, quite often, I mean, one aspect of advertising is short-term campaigns to sell product or to communicate a new product to the marketplace. Strategic communications is much more than that. It certainly incorporates aspects of advertising, but it also incorporates policy work and working to help shape and communicate policy, as well as PR, as well as a longer-term ambition of the client and more of a responsible projection of a client's ambitions over the long term.
I mean, as someone that's worked in this field for a while now, Sven, when you're looking at news bulletins, reading newspapers, how much of what we're reading is strategic communications and how much of it is really exactly what a journalist from a completely detached point of view is writing as what they see as the truth?
I think there's less independent truth out there. And I think you're reaching a point, perhaps in the industry now, in the media landscape, where paid for news is really the way to go for well-informed news. So, for example, the paywall that the Times has up is the price you pay for well-informed journalism, where journalists can be properly funded to do proper investigative journalism, and that is principled and independent.
Because increasingly, it's all free, isn't it? I mean, you go into London, you get the Evening Standard stuffed at you, Metro, various other newspapers. We're not paying for those at all. So the implication, from what you're saying, seems to be that that is going to be less reliable information.
Well, I think we're facing a reality, and I think it's you know, we have to change the way we look at news now in the advent of social media, which is the moment you've put a technology into people's hands which enables everyone to become a journalist or at least have a point of view and become a commentator, it is getting increasingly difficult to define, therefore, what is accurate and well-informed news and what is speculation, false news, post-truth news, and what is really just commentary rather than factual investigative journalism. And I think that's the reality that we now face, and that will shape the future of our media landscape. And we now need to find new ways to find our footing, really, in that new reality.
But, I mean, we've got there's one little expression I give to you, which is WMD. We had this, which was cooked up as an excuse to invade Iraq, which was peddled by all the mainstream media. That was fake news. So how can you say that the bloggers are somehow more of a danger, because the mainstream media is quite clearly peddling this fake news too?
No, well, certainly two things there. First of all, I didn't say that the bloggers were more of a danger.
What's that, blipping? We can't.
A new reality that we need to find our footing in. Secondly, with regards to weapons of mass destruction, and if we trace that back to the, you know, what infamously called the dodgy dossier, I absolutely accept, and I think you're entirely right to say that politicians and, you know, certainly for the last decade and perhaps longer, have increasingly become, by being so heavily spun and by using and perhaps constructing news in the way that they have now created a landscape in which that somehow is now sort of authenticating anyone, therefore, to say whatever they like.
The trouble with WMD was that we had a massive demonstration. Something like over a million people came out on the streets because they didn't believe the WMD. It's almost like when the mainstream media is lying, as it was. I mean, in fact, even the BBC sacked the director general and the reporter concerned, even though what they were telling was absolutely the truth about the dodgy dossier you mentioned. The people were sort of ignoring it. And I know George Orwell, back in the Second World War, resigned from his job at the BBC in the World Service doing propaganda to India because he said he didn't think it worked. And the whole business with the weapons of mass destruction does kind of suggest that.
Well, as I say, look, I'm certainly not here to defend the dodgy dossier. What I would assess based on the available evidence that I have is that once a dodgy dossier was constructed and represented to the media by government as being factually accurate, the fact then that the media networks picked up on that and represented that to the people, I'm not sure if you could therefore say that they were somehow, you know, it was sort of intent on their part to become part of that conspiracy. I don't know where the line there would be between the media being part of the conspiracy or reporting what was being said to them by a government at the time. Where that line is, I think, is a little bit blurred in that case. But there is no question at all that the examples like that have created an atmosphere where there is sort of an expectation of lies from politicians, and that expectation of lies is now creating cynicism towards a lot of the media, which sometimes is particularly unfair because there is extremely good journalism out there and extremely capable investigative journalism out there. So I think there are nuances in here that I think we need to be very careful not to create false binaries. And I think it's very easy to find conspiracy under every stone that you turn over. I think what we have to do is have an intelligent, informed debate now as to what is the new reality and how are we going to navigate our way through it.
Now, because, you're saying that the bloggers and the blogosphere, the ability of people to talk to a large audience, to sort of have social media, a lot of social media hits or whatever, is potentially a threat to democracy. But then, hang on a minute, because the actual threat surely comes from the sorts of lies that can come out through mainstream media. And actually, the real threat, some are saying anyway, is to the mainstream media itself, because the social media is starting to undermine the credibility of some of the stories that are coming out in the mainstream media. So whereabouts do you stand on that particular spectrum?
Again, I think you need to be very careful in terms of, first of all, not putting words into my mouth in terms of what I'm saying here. There is absolutely no question at all that some of the mainstream media are politically aligned. And therefore, it is absolutely right and sensible that anyone approaching any of the mainstream media applies a lens of cynicism and of source verification and of looking for not just single source, but multiple sources. However, I think we also need to be careful. If you look just today, for example, I was just looking today at some pieces of commentary that are being put out by Tommy Loren in America, where she's citing as a response to the visa ban, the Muslim ban introduced by Trump, is recounting that Obama also put a 6-month ban in place for Iraqi refugees. Well, actually, you know, if you dig on that story that's just been put out by her, in fact, it's not actually true either. So she's sort of using to justify her political position, perhaps, again, false news. Because in fact, in May 2011, you know, two Iraqi refugees were arrested in Kentucky on suspicion of plotting a terrorist attack. Yes, absolutely. One of them had fingerprints that matched fingerprints on a roadside bomb in Iraq. And as a consequence of that, Obama set in chain, you know, a review of 57,000 Iraqi refugees' visas, which delayed their process by 6 months. Now, it's not true and fair to say that that was a visa ban, you know. And that's just one piece that's out there from an alternative news source that we wouldn't necessarily say is mainstream media.
No, you're right. And it wasn't a travel ban either, was it?
Exactly. You know, so there are so many different voices now in the debate. I mean, if you look at the way in which Russia has represented the Ukraine situation, you know, the first thing that Putin did was close down the mainstream media and folded into Russia Today. That was number one. Number two, there's been an entire language change in terms of associating some of the people against Russia in Ukraine as being aligned with fascists. Then there's been a management of other this is hybrid warfare.
Okay, well, hang on, because the Kiev government also closed down a Russian language channel, actually banned Russian, even though a lot of people in Ukraine speak Russian. So there was both sides. I mean, it seems to me that the media plays a very important role in any kind of conflict like this.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that they banned Russian. I mean, we're getting very heavily into the weeds, Tony, but I don't think it's actually fair to say that they constitutionally banned Russian, actually. I think if you fact check that. But what can we do about it? Look, we are where we are. I think we can all agree that there are people who are constructing their views. There are politicians who are constructing the news. There are also commentators who are constructing the news and also mainstream media. I think we can all agree that the construction of the news is happening on all sides. Now, what can we do about that is hopefully instill through our education system and our general awareness in the public, are the techniques to look out for, are the signs and the symptoms of constructed news to look out for. And it's only by educating everyone that then we can actually have a sort of an informed basis by which we can then, for ourselves, assess based on the evidence what to believe, what not to believe, and what might be politically motivated or motivated by, for example, the requirement of people to put a lot of hits on their website, because by serving up adverts to millions of people, you can make money. So commercially motivated, you know, we've got to see through some of the techniques, and then as a general population, then we can make our own decisions. And I think that's a healthy democratic process. But at the moment, perhaps the general public is a few steps behind in terms of recognizing some of the symptoms and the traits of fake news.
Now, I first came across you when you were making a documentary. And, of course, this is really important that independent filmmakers are able to get some kind of decent national airing for the films they make. How did you get on with that?
Oh, well, actually, it was a personal project. I mean, that's something completely separate, Tony, which was just a personal project interviewing people in this space, because it's been self-evident that we were going towards what is now perhaps being crystallized by perhaps the Trump campaign, perhaps other campaigns that are going on in Europe at the moment, where it is becoming increasingly difficult to tell fact from fiction, but it is increasingly important to tell fact from fiction. So the time that we met was investigating, you know, for personal reasons and professional reasons, you know, what is going on, what are the trends in the news that are happening, so as to better inform myself as a member of the public, but also as a professional working in this area, to better find the footing in this new landscape. So, I mean, what we perhaps need to look at in this space is the difference between what is made up and what is a slant of the news. And I think, you know, there's an important difference there. You know, if things are fundamentally made up, then we need to be calling them out as fake news. If they are a slant, then we need to understand what is the motivation of that person to apply a slant to this news story. Okay, and some of the things you can look out for are, you know, stories that are clearly appealing to your confirmation bias, you know, your wish to hear what you want to hear. And from both sides in the Brexit debate, that was very evident that confirmation bias was taking place. Well, there were very few sources of news that were actually looking independently at the whole process, saying, you know, a plague on both your houses, really. This is untrue, but this is also untrue. And this is true, and this is also true from both sides. And I think that's where really well-informed media can play a role now, is to apply a lens to both sides of the debate.
Now, what were you trying to achieve with your own documentary?
In that instance, as I've just said to you, it was to find and understand people who were dealing in this emerging landscape and were anticipating where we are today. So I was talking to a range of people involved in commercial and governmental roles in this area to anticipate, you know, what we see now as the prevalence of ambiguous news.
Okay, fake news, ambiguous news. But look, I mean, there's nothing new about this, is there? I mentioned the WMD. We had the scare over the Syrian chemical weapons attack, which is now very much in doubt who did that. This is back in 2015, I think, in the summer, with both Carla Del Ponte from the United Nations and Seymour Hersh, who's a very well-respected US investigative journalist, saying that actually it looks much more likely that the rebels were behind that attack rather than the Syrian government. Then if you go back, you can look at something like Pearl Harbor, the attack on the United States in 1941 in Hawaii, which led to the US entry into World War II, things like that. You can look at that as a specific example of there having been some sort of foreknowledge, but the idea was to bounce the population and people who might otherwise be reluctant into World War II. So there's nothing new about this. I just wonder whether you think that there's any way to recognise when we get some sort of, particularly something like 9/11, a big event like this, which is what you might call spectacular thing on our TV screens, carried live, this sort of thing, how to unpick it and to start to decide, well, is this a put-up job or is this for real?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it goes back much further, of course, than the Second World War. I mean, it goes right the way back to Genghis Khan you know, the Roman Empire were using these kind of techniques.
Now, give us some examples. How is Genghis Khan and the Romans using these techniques?
I think it was Genghis Khan was using saddles that were far too big on horses, on huge horses, and sending those towards the enemy before a fight, on the night before a fight, so that the enemy would believe that they were fighting giants. You know, it was entirely, you know, communications to achieve an effect, a behavioral effect, you know, in the same way as it would be often the case from warfare way back when of people leaving one person alive so that it could go and tell the deeds of the victorious side to other people so that they wouldn't fight them. You know, there are lots of techniques, certainly from you know, war fighting techniques that have used false information, false flags, and like you say, right the way through the Second World War with the political warfare executive and Operation Mincemeat and so many other different operations that have now been quite celebrated in the publications of books and so forth. But this is happening, of course, today, right now. I mean, if you look at the Quebec shooting, and in answer to your question, what can we look out for? What should we look out for? I think the Quebec incident recently was a real case in point, which is, in fact, the suspect was a 27-year-old white French Canadian, Alexandre Bissonnette, if I've pronounced his name correctly. Now, you know, when that shooting happened, the first things that social media were saying was, this was a Moroccan, this was a Syrian refugee. Now, that was on RT, that was on Fox. These were on mainstream broadcasts.
That's right. It wasn't just social media. It was the mainstream media that were saying that, wasn't it? Social media were picking up on it.
Exactly. You know, well, no, I think it was the other way around, actually. Sorry. I think it was the bots that were pushing out on social media first, and then mainstream media picked up on it. But then more worryingly, you then hear the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, responding to the story, understanding it in those terms, and then coming out with a statement saying it's a terrible reminder of why we must remain vigilant and why the president is taking steps to be proactive rather than reactive when it comes to our nation's safety and security. So even there, you have the White House press secretary at least endorsing the Muslim ban on the basis of this story, which he was, you know, obviously receiving false information at the time, or at least listening to false information, when actually it was the Muslim community that was actually suffering. You know, and I think we need to be very, very careful to pause and get our facts right and check the sourcing of our news before we comment. And that's both on social media, and that's the main media, but that's also the politicians as well. The speed of the news at the moment is so fast. I think one of the first things we must all do, if we're in this industry, if we're in the media industry, and also if we're citizens, is to stop and think, has the person I'm hearing this from, are they a respected publication? You know, is it a respected source? And that doesn't mean it has to be mainstream. It also just, are they a respected, trusted source? And it doesn't matter if it's a blogger or mainstream or a politician. You know, can I find this information elsewhere and check it elsewhere? You know, could it be something else? Could it be the agenda of someone else that I'm falling into the trap of following? You know, is it having an effect on me that is intentionally sort of emotionally arousing? Because of course people pass on information that they feel emotionally aroused, whether or not they feel disgust or whether or not they feel anger. You know, that is a way of creating retelling in this space.
And it sounds to me, Sven, as if you're saying we can't trust the news, we just have to literally double check almost anything that we're suspicious about.
I think there's some truth in that. And as I said at the beginning of this, I think there is a role now for paid-for media, which you know you are paying for respectable journalists to do investigative journalism. I think it sings the praises of respectable journalists everywhere, and that's good, and that's proper. And if that's the price for being well-informed, which is the small price of buying a well-respected newspaper or tuning into a well-respected source of journalism, well, that's a very good
thing. Like this one, of course.
Of course, absolutely, Tony. And then you come from a background of trained by the BBC, and that you know obviously stands you in good stead that you understand about source verification.
Yes,
so
I was trained at the time of the weapons of mass destruction story.
So even more reason. There we are. Yeah.
Anyway, look, today we've just had this week actually, Damian Collins, Conservative MP, is saying the growth of fake news undermines confidence in the media in general and undermines democracy. If you had an audience with the Culture, Media and Sport Committee and this new investigation into fake news, what would you be saying to them?
Well, I think it's fantastic that they're doing that, first and foremost, and I think it's absolutely right to do it. I think, again, I just reiterate, I don't think there's a need or I don't think it's helpful to be sort of finger pointing either way, and I hope it's an honest and sensible discussion that takes place in that forum, because you know Facebook are making steps in the right direction. They're one of the steps is they're enlisting the International Fact Checking Network which is a branch of the Florida-based journalism think tank Pointer. You know, there is good work being done by Snopes. There's good work being done by Le Monde, who have their decoders app, you know, and software. There is good work being done by, you know, algorithms that are flagging a suspicious news and actually sort of flagging it when it's shared online and so forth. So, you know, the technology has moved at such a pace. Perhaps it's not surprising that now, you know, we are playing a little bit of catch up, I think, within the industry at large. And that includes the sources in the form of mainstream media. That includes the journalists. That includes the public. And I think we collectively have to work together to say, right, how are we going to put in place the right mechanisms so that we promote democracy and we don't infringe on democracy? But we also have some way of finding an increased level of attribution, but also that we educate this generation, but also the next generation, in terms of source checking and understanding that it is a responsibility of the individual to pause, to think, and to deconstruct the media that they're receiving or the information that they're receiving before they like, share, and promote it themselves.
Now, look, some people will say, Sven, that it's the likes of you, strategic communications people, that have been using the media to push particular lines that have actually led to these accusations of fake news, because some of the stories that have been coming out clearly have been fake.
Well, I think if anyone looks and Googles my name, they'll see the work that we've been doing against Daesh. And I would defend our role very strongly in terms of our moral and ethical compass in terms of the work that we do. So, I mean, to answer back on that, if there is anyone that's out there that's feeling that, you know, we are very strongly involved in identifying the fake techniques and fake news that comes out of terrorist organizations and the promises of that are put forward in terms of the caliphate that are recruiting young, vulnerable audiences around Europe and internationally. We are counteracting those narratives and promoting informed counter-narratives that are, you know, absolutely factually accurate. We are all about enfranchising citizen journalism. We're all about, through the work that we've been doing with Families Against Terrorism Extremism, enfranchising families to recognise the signs of recruitment, to become journalists in their own right, to be able to counter narrative back on their own terms. So I would very strongly rebuke anyone that was to try and level such an accusation.
Okay, but what about things like these so-called ISIS videos, which seem to have surfaced not from anywhere in the Middle East, but at this place called the Site Intelligence Group over in Bethesda, Maryland, which is just round the corner from the CIA?
Well, I actually genuinely don't know anything about those, so I can't really comment on those. I mean,
it's called the Search for International Terrorist Entities, and they have been the source. They seem to, anyway, saying, well, we find these videos before they're published on the internet. So they're not kind of hoovering them up from online in the Arab world. They are actually producing them there themselves. Anyway, look, let's leave that. It's not something you've come across.
Sorry, you've asked a question. Let me answer it.
Sure, yeah.
In that instance, I think the best thing you could do is to try and, obviously, as an investigative journalist, then search down who is making, if you're alleging that they're sort of false videos, exactly to the point, is then search down who's promoting them, what is their reason, and then everyone can have an informed debate about that. But
recently in Egypt, there was a film crew arrested. I don't know if you came across this, actually faking some kind of Syrian scene, you know, this aspect of it is very worrying as some of this footage has actually been used by the mainstream media.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course it is. And I think what's reassuring in the way you just presented that is they were arrested and they were caught, creating fake news by the sounds of it. You know, so that's exactly, I think, the point that we can completely agree on, which is if individuals are doing it, if governments are doing it, I think we probably disagree to the extent that which Russia is doing it. And that's fine that your position on that. But, you know, my position quite firmly is that Russia is using information warfare as part of a hybrid warfare communications technique, and Russia today is clearly part of that, to what extent you could say, you know, to what degree is arguable, but my position is certainly that they are involved in that, and the representation of the West and the situation in the Ukraine is part of that. I think we need a good, healthy debate about this in the public. And if the government is putting in place an investigation into fake news, you know, I'd certainly fully endorse it and think it's very sensible for our society that we can have the ability to know that the where to find credible, informed, investigative journalism that is independent, that believes in the principles of strong journalism. I think that's extremely important for our democracy, and we must all work together to ensure that happens.
I mean, yes, you mentioned Russia Today, but here in Britain, of course, we've got the BBC. And if you look at the coverage from both those channels of the Ukraine conflict, they're both very partisan. You know, one showing the Russian point of view almost exclusively, and the other one showing the Western point of view almost exclusively. In fact, when that was all happening, the only channel I was getting any sense, I felt anyway, from was Al Jazeera, who were completely out of the war completely. And so I think that's sometimes one way you can get through this. But anyway, we had an interview with a former United Nations military analyst on here a few weeks ago. A guy goes under the pen name The Saker. And he said that modern warfare is 80% information warfare, 15% economic warfare, and only about 5% real shooting wars. As someone that's worked in psychological operations yourself, is that something you think that's a roughly accurate figure?
Well, what I can say is, if it is, I'm quite pleased to hear that in some respects, because, you know, I firmly believe in dialogue over division. I think, you know, if you have to resort to kinetic activities, it's called in the military context, if you have to shoot people, it means you can't change their mind, can you? You know, so I'm a firm believer in the principle of my companies are to stand for dialogue over division, to find ways to enable informed dialogue between very heated oppositional groups sometimes, and to find a middle ground that we can create sensible conversations where people can come together. Now, we learnt that in Ireland. You know, it's only through discussing with Sinn Féin that we could, you know, dilute the conflict there from IRA and the conflict as it was. We know that from Bosnia and Bosnia-Herzegovina and obviously with Serbia and in that entire area. We know that from parts of Africa. We know that from the Second World War. There comes a point at which everyone has to sit down and talk. So if that can be used sensibly to moderate everyone, you know, to avoid conflict, I think that's a fantastic thing. And I hope everyone listening to this would agree with that. Now, within that, though, it means that information can become a weapon system, and weaponized words are definitely being used from both sides. Now, that is both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing because it now means that the landscape, therefore, is more cynical. It is more constructed. And you know, I completely agree. It's constructed, as I said, by the people, by the politics, by the commentators, and by the militaries. There's no question about that. So all we can do in that context is create an environment where people can spot this, where they are educated and informed to recognize when they have affected and constructed news coming towards them and make informed decisions going forward based on that fact. It is true to say you're probably not going to get completely independent news from the BBC and not completely independent news from RT and certainly not from Fox or from CNN. But it's only by hopefully people taking the time to look around at all the different news sources, then they can come with their friends and with their family and with their colleagues and with their peer groups to an informed, debated, constructive conversation where they can make their decisions. You know, now, I don't suppose that's any different than it was from Greek times, you know, or from Roman times. You know, it's a different technology that we're dealing with. That's
okay,
all.
With psychological warfare, though, is it possible nowadays to actually take over a country, persuade people to put down their weapons without a shot being fired?
Well, I think Russia and the Crimea is a pretty good example. You know, I mean, I don't think a shot was fired in the Crimea. Whether or not you would say, you know, that without question, there was a psychological operations or a hybrid warfare operations conducted towards the Ukraine. There is towards Crimea. There is one being conducted at the moment with Ukraine. You know, so absolutely that is possible. Now, arguably, you could say, OK, well, is that just working with the will of the people on either side of the argument? Well, perhaps it is. Perhaps, you know, there's nuances within this. But is it better than having a war? Yes. You know, so, you know, there's a reality check that has to go on. I mean, you know, is it better to be in the situation where we have to scratch our heads and say, okay, look, we're struggling to find out what's the truth and what's not the truth, as distinct from we're shooting each other? I'd argue that the former is a desirable place to be, even if it means we now have to change the way in which we look at
media. It sounds to me as if you're saying propaganda does work, so we should be doing more of it.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the opportunity now for independent media within that space is very exciting, and I think the landscape will change. And as you said, Al Jazeera is gaining a name for itself. Vice News is gaining a name for itself. You know, certain bloggers are gaining a name for themselves, and perhaps are becoming, and certain paid-for media. I use the Times as an example just because I know them quite well. But, you know, in terms of, you know, if people want to go through the paywall to get informed and well-informed news, you know, then so be it. Then they can get educated with a breadth of information on the subject and make their own decisions. I mean, I'm not for a moment thinking that if someone is well informed, therefore you can win them over with propaganda. I don't think you can. And I think we saw that with the Remain campaign attempting that through the Brexit vote. You know, I mean, I think you had a government trying very hard there to use every single technique in the book, and really arguably an information war with false claims of what would happen if we voted out and so forth. And it didn't work. The people just turned around and said, actually, I don't believe that. I don't think it's credible. I don't think it's right. And I'm not prepared to vote that way. You know, so for all the attempts that were made, perhaps to use propaganda techniques on the Remain side, it didn't work.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Sideways with Sue Jones. Hi, Sue. So what have party balloons and the Large Hadron Collider got in common?
Well, they've got helium in common. It's absolutely crucial to both of them. So helium is, as you say, it's the second most abundant element in the universe. So there's masses of it around everywhere except for on Earth, it seems. So a quarter of the sun consists of helium, and roughly a quarter of the universe does. But there's not much on Earth, because once it gets to the surface of Earth, it's so light, as you know, it just floats up and away into space and it's gone. And we've got no way of making any more. So it's irreplaceable.
So what's helium used for? Is mankind using it up?
Yes, we're using it for all sorts of things. First of all, I want to ask you, what do you know about helium, Tony?
Oh, all I know is that if you breathe it in, your voice changes and goes all squeaky. I don't think it's not poisonous.
No, it isn't.
So that's about it, I'm afraid.
Okay. So, but what? You've hit on a very important thing there. That's because it's so light. After hydrogen, it's the lightest atom on Earth. And so it's much lighter than the normal atmosphere we breathe. So when you breathe helium in, your vocal cords can vibrate much more quickly, which is why your voice goes up. So one of the key things is that it's light. And that's why it's used for party balloons, because, of course, they want to float up and into outer space. It's used for weather balloons, and it's used for airships. And although hydrogen is lighter, which is better for airships, what is the drawback of hydrogen?
It's explosive.
Exactly.
Yes, you don't really want your airship to go down in a ball of flames.
No.
So you use helium, if you can find any.
Yes, which is inert, so it's not flammable, which is really good. Okay, so the next property about it, so we've got it, it's that it's very light. It's also, as I say, inert. It was called a noble gas. It can't form compounds with anything, and that's why it doesn't kind of combine with anything on Earth and stay here. It just, once it gets to the surface, up it goes into outer space and it's gone.
So what's a noble gas? It sounds a little bit sort of posh.
It does. It stays aloof from the other elements. It won't react.
A snooty gas.
Yes, it won't react with them, you see. It won't have anything to do with them. So it can't form compounds with anything. So although hydrogen is lighter, and you'd think that that would disappear up into the atmosphere, it doesn't, because it combines with oxygen and forms water and all sorts of other elements. It's busy reacting with them all, and it stays down on Earth. But because helium doesn't react with anything, off it goes into the atmosphere.
Hey, so the problem here is, really, it's so light, it just keeps disappearing off into outer space.
It does. So we've only got a certain amount on Earth, and once we've used it, we can't replace it. And, you know, once it just goes up into the air and it's gone. what it's good for, because it's inert, because it won't react with things, it's good for growing silicon crystals, which make silicon chips for computers. You can mix it with oxygen, and it's used for deep sea divers. It's good for a protective...
Oh, it stops them getting the bends, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it forms a protective atmosphere for arc welding. So it's got quite a few uses because it's inert. But then there's another absolutely key thing why helium is such a useful thing in modern life. It's got very low freezing and boiling points. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. How low do you think it's freezing? Its freezing and boiling points are only 3 degrees centigrade apart. But
wow.
How low do you think they go?
Freezing and boiling, only 3 degrees centigrade apart. Well, I suppose, minus 200 Celsius?
Oh, nearly there, yes. Oh, he's good, isn't he?
Well, it's just a guess.
This is about as close to absolute zero
as
you can get.
Yes, it's going to be pretty cold, isn't it?
It is. So the boiling...
So absolute zero is the coldest it's possible to be. That's when there's no heat at all, and it's all gone.
Minus 269 is its boiling point, and minus 272, 3 degrees colder, is the freezing point. So when it's a liquid, it's between minus 269 and minus 272. It's about as cold as you can make things, and that means it's brilliant for cooling stuff down. It cools down superconducting magnets, which is what you've got in the Large Hadron Collider. So it's a key part of keeping that cool. And it's used in MRI scanners in medicine to keep them cool. It's used for research into atomic structure. It's so cold that the atoms that are normally jiggling about like anything slow down, and you can actually see what's going on. And it's used in the space industry to keep the satellite instruments cool and to keep fuel cool. So it's really very necessary for modern life.
Okay, so where do you find it?
You find it in the rocks. So it's a product of radioactive decay. So if you've got uranium, then gradually over hundreds of millions of years, from kind of uranium in the centre of the Earth, it gradually decays, and the helium gets up as far as the Earth's crust. And that's where you get it from.
So, I mean, would it be mixed with gas? You know, they're pumping all this gas out of the North Sea, for example. Will you find a bit of helium in there?
Yes, you find it in some underground natural gas fields, but it's been a bit hit and miss where they find it up to now. And it is quite expensive to get out.
So how come it's so cheap you can use it in party balloons then?
Well, this is an interesting thing. Back in the 1920s, America, you know, they discovered... somebody discovered helium, and America thought this is good for airships, and if we are involved in more wars, we might need lots of helium to fill up airships to use in wars. So America stockpiled helium between 1920 and 1990. They had loads and loads of helium stockpiled, and then by 1990 they realised that, you know, warfare had kind of progressed since the 1920s.
Yeah, I don't know if an airship is going to really be the cutting edge of modern warfare.
Absolutely. So in the 1990s they realised exactly that.
But meanwhile, the price has gone up. So they made a fortune.
Well, when they sold all this helium, that's when prices absolutely plunged.
Oh, okay.
And that's when people got the idea, oh, we can use it in party balloons, you see. But the price has gone up since then. But, people are still using it for party balloons.
Some eminent scientists have called for a ban on the frivolous use of helium in party balloons. So this is falling out of favour. They've called for us to stop squandering this precious resource.
They did. In 2012, we've had two key scientists, somebody who won the Nobel Physics Prize, Robert Richardson, and the Cambridge scientist, calling for realistic pricing. And what the physics Nobel Prize winner reckoned is that we should be paying £75 for one party balloon if the pricing was going to be realistic. And they were calling for a ban on frivolous use of it because it's possibly the only non-renewable resource on the planet and it's being wasted. So there was a lot of concern about the helium supply, really, at that point.
So what about now?
Well, The thing is, the ban on balloons didn't happen because since then there's been some more research, and a couple of years ago they found that helium can find its way from the rocks deep down in the ground into groundwater and underground reservoirs and they know better now where to find it, as a result of which they found some more in America under the Rocky Mountains, and they found a lot in the Rift Valley in Africa. But even though they found a lot there, they're still saying enough for several years, whereas, of course, you know, we could have hundreds more years when we need it. So although there are people saying, well, there's a lot more on the moon than on Earth, and we could go up there and mine it, I'm not sure how.
I think it'd be even more expensive. I know you can still get it. It's around about £25 for a canister, which would inflate 50 balloons for you. So this attempt to get it banned has completely failed, hasn't it?
It has. It has. So it's watch this space, really.
Sue Jones with a look at helium there. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, and I'm joined now by James Grosvenor, although I'm not sure if you pronounce it. I pronounce it right, James, from the Rochdale Herald.
It sounds good to me.
Yeah, okay, so you don't really mind how your name is pronounced. That's great for a newspaper editor. That's the sort of relaxed attitude I think we could do with more with the London media. But anyway, James, tell us a little bit about your outlet, the Rochdale Herald.
The Rochdale Herald's actually been going since June 2016. We started originally, how shall I put this? I think if a couple of us came together on Facebook, we were kind of angry people, really. We were really dismayed by the amount of false propaganda and general naivety of the public, particularly on the right-wing element, I have to say. There were various, you're aware of pages like Britain First, a page with 1.5 million followers, and half a dozen members who basically spend their time spreading fake news and general hate speech.
So you were discussing fake news before Merkel and Obama in November 2016 then?
Oh, absolutely. We've been rebelling against it for a long while. I mean, we were closely involved with pages like Spellchecker Racist and the wonderful George Eliot Foundation.
So what was Spellchecker Racist? That sounds like that's a site I've not seen before. Tell us what they do there.
Oh, it was a wonderful Facebook page, actually, where they basically confronted bigots and highlighted and lampooned the basic lack of coherency, lack of control over the English language they seem so proud to support.
So anyway, you've got the Rochdale Herald now, which is a sort of you've got all sorts of spoof stories on there. I noticed just having a quick flick through, Mexico has offered to purchase the Channel Tunnel after Brexit. Is that a real story? Is that fake news?
Well, I haven't got authority that it could be true.
Also, the Daily Mail have issued an apology that calling the white mosque shooter in Quebec a terrorist, because the Daily Mail obviously would never call anyone who was white a terrorist.
Yes, but I don't think that can be true, because when has the Daily Mail ever issued an apology?
Also, the Statue of Liberty to be deported by Donald Trump, is that true or not?
Well, I believe that Canada have put in an offer for it, because they believe it would look rather good in Quebec.
So, I mean, you know, I can see what you're doing, and actually it's quite good to have a bit more satire, because, I mean, if you go roll back, you know, sort of 5-10 years, you had people like Mark Thomas, Rory Bremner, lots of really good satirical and well-aimed at the power elite, you know, the people in power, satire programmes on our TV screens. There's just, I mean, are you as frustrated as me that there's just this kind of lack of satire today?
I don't think there's a lack of satire. I think it's more the case that, is there such a thing as a serious satirist? But satire is generally being put into the fake news genre, I think, by the press these days. I'm not sure why that's happening, because obviously there's been a lot of bad news, shall I say, over the past couple of years at least. I mean, this is what's brought us Trump. We got outlets such as Breitbart, The New Observer, Daily Express, The Daily Mail, basically putting out stories which are blatantly untrue and with a clear political agenda. Whereas we don't have a political agenda. We have people writing for us who are on both sides of the fence. And I think what we are really, I think inside we're probably quite angry people. But you can express your anger in two ways. You can scream and you can shout, or you can mock. And I think this is what we choose to do.
Now, you weren't mocking when you sent me this tweet, were you, from Sophia Elahi, who is a researcher for Five Live. Tell me how come they got in touch with you.
Well, I think there was possibly in the press, there was a story about a body being found on Saddleworth Moor. And
this is the notorious place for the Yorkshire Ripper.
Yes, it is. And being from Rochdale, clearly she's not from Rochdale, she obviously thought that she'd get some local knowledge. And she tweeted us to ask if we had any information about this. And we thought it was a very sad state of affairs for the world when real news comes and asks alternative news for the inside info.
Right, well, I mean, presumably someone's trained her as a researcher, and she hasn't bothered to check to see if she's coming to a satirical news site to ask for a lead on a serious story.
Well, or perhaps she could have been having a laugh. I don't know. Maybe it was too subtle for us.
I mean, what do you make of this? Because, I mean, there is this sense that we're told that we're living in a post-truth world, that really there's no way to tell if something's true or not.
Well, yes, there is. You can actually read past paragraph one, and I think there's usually a clue. When we start calling President Trump a gibbon-faced lunatic, I think it's fair to say that we're perhaps not Guardian.
Well, they'd probably like to call him a gibbon-faced lunatic, but I suppose the point of all of this is that there is this kind of competition really going on between people who are in the mainstream, that is to say, have got an outlet of absolutely millions, broadcasters and newspapers, and bloggers and people at the Rochdale Herald. Do you think any one is more reliable than the other?
I think we're infinitely more reliable. Seriously, I don't think any of them can be reliable. Really, you have to use your judgment when you read everything and take everything with a pinch of salt, because unless you're going to research everything you read, you're going to be misled.
Now, I mean, people will say that you're just putting these headlines up there as, you know, what they call clickbait in order to get people to click on it, and you're making money out of the advertising like that.
Oh, I'd love people to click and come and read our adverts and read our stories, because the difference is that everything we earn goes to charity. We don't make a profit out of this. We actually run at a loss. We don't pay our writers, even though we promised them we might one day. But we do what we do for charity. Only just before Christmas, I'll refer back to Britain First. Paul Golding, the leader of Britain First, ex-leader of Britain First, got arrested and imprisoned. He got 8 weeks in prison for invading mosques, but he was told to stay well away from them. So we promptly set up the Paul Golding-sponsored jail term page. And in a little over a week, we raised £5,500 for the Refugee Council.
Well, it sounds like you're doing something quite useful there. How do people contribute to your Rochdale Herald? And the other thing, of course, is, are you actually in Rochdale? Are you allowed to tell us?
Oh, some of us are. I did actually spend a week there one afternoon, and it's a lovely place. And we will be having our annual general meeting there in not too distant future. We're planning this at this very moment. So,
in one of the pubs, I imagine. You sound to me like you're in London. Through your accent.
I've been to London. I was born in London.
We're trying to track you down. The Rochdale Herald. Are there any Rochdales in other parts of the world, not even in England?
I was speaking to Victoria Derbyshire the other day on the television, and I don't believe she's actually broadcasting from Derbyshire. So, you know, things aren't always what they appear. But I think Rochdale has a proud heritage of newsworthy material.
And have you actually done any real interviews with people like Trump and Farage?
Unfortunately, he did try to call me. Trump did try to call me, but I was unavailable for comment. It would be nice, wouldn't it? We did have a photograph taken with Jeremy Corbyn once. So we do actually have a photograph of Jeremy Corbyn next to a Rochdale Herald T-shirt. So I think our claim to fame, I think, is actually been cemented.
So isn't that? I thought what I'd heard was rumours that that was just photoshopped.
No, it was actually true. It was actually true.
Well, look, I don't know how to believe someone. If someone from an editor of a satirical news site tells me something's true, should I believe them or not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Until otherwise informed, I think you should take it all as, take it all in good faith.
And what do you think has been your biggest scoop?
We had some wonderful ones during the Olympics when I think there was an incident where we had an athlete with alopecia who was Daily Mail put her on the back page when everybody else was on the front page. And we wrote an article about that, and I think it reached something like 75,000 views in 75 seconds or something like that, and our site exploded. I think we've had a number. I mean, there's been so many, it's really hard to single out any particular favourite. I mean, I have my favourites, other people have their favourites.
So what's your favourite then?
I mean, there is one which I can't repeat on the air recently about Susan Boyle and Dead Kennedys, but I'll leave your listeners to look that one up themselves.
Okay. Also, we've got the Parliament taking this all very, very seriously and looking into the whole phenomenon of fake news. Uh-huh. And, of course, they're pointing to websites like yours, satirical sites.
I don't believe they are.
Part of that great mix. Well, the thing is, So what would you have to say to the Culture and Media and Sport Committee, should you get the opportunity?
Not a lot, really, because I don't think that they... I think this perception that satire is being mixed up with fake news is not really... What's happening on social media. But in an interview the other day, we were speaking... What the other person being interviewed was actually the minister who set up this parliamentary inquiry. And he was very adamant that there is a strong distinction between satire and fake news. The sites they're looking at are sites like Breitbart, New Observer, and people are actually putting out political propaganda, putting out hate speech, putting out horrible stories about children being murdered and raped in America by groups like Black Lives Matter, which is clearly untrue, clearly unresearched, and it's purely rabble rousing. I don't think anyone with half a brain cell would put us in that basket. We wouldn't do things like that. We don't say things like that. And we despise people who do.
And without ridiculing the right, where is humanity heading? Because there doesn't seem to be, it's good to see you doing it. There doesn't seem to be enough. You know, what sort of direction is society going to take if there aren't sites like you and others around ridiculing?
I shudder to think, because what we see now, I mean, to my point of view, I mean, people would disagree with me, but to my point of view, what we're seeing now is a repeat of 1930s Germany. The idea is discredit the press and people's hearts and minds will follow. It's truly scary. It's truly scary. I mean, before we started the Rochdale Herald, we did indulge in a little bit of mischief. I don't know if you remember a particular incident regarding Urdu road signs in Bradford, where there was a story which somehow found its way onto the right-wing press about road signs in Bradford being both in Urdu and in English. the signs were actually in Arabic and read things like, may God be with you, and other various rude things and things like that. And it was just really just a little, we were really having a bit of fun at the expense of the right wing. And we thought, oh, I don't suppose anyone will really fall for it, but let's just put it out there for a laugh, because we had nothing better to do at the time. And this was all very well and good until Katie Hopkins picked it up and tweeted with it, and it absolutely caused an uproar. So, and I think that was back in the day before we really had a direction. We were just, I think we were rebelling at the time. We were fighting hatred with mockery. This is what we were trying to do. And we thought, well, no, we can do better than this. We can be more satirical. We can actually do something positive. We can actually start raising money for causes rather than just knocking people back all the time. And we, in our mind, if it's absurd, it's going to get written about. This is what we do. We don't care if we mock the left, the right, the middle. We don't care. You've got to have a laugh, haven't you? You've got to amuse people. And people have commented that it's just nice to actually read our stories first and then go back and see where they were grounded. Because it sheds a whole new light on the world, I think.
James, how do people find you online?
RochdaleHerald.co.uk. And we also still have a Just Giving page at www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Rochdale-Herald. And that's actually doing really good work. It's gone a little bit quiet lately, so if you'd like to pop in and say hello, we'd really appreciate it. And you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter.
And if people are interested in writing for you, interested in what you're doing, because you're on a mission, aren't you?
We're on a mission from God. Yes, yes, by all means, we're always looking for new writers and new talent. And if anybody really wants an outlet for their talent, then please, please leave us a message on Facebook. You can message us there, and we're always open to submissions. We've got quite a happy team, and it is good fun, and it basically puts a little bit of humour back into the world, which I think we're sorely needing at the moment.
Okay, James Grosswiner or Vina, depending on how you're feeling today. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sven Hughes, former psychological warfare officer, now working in his own strategic communications firm. Also to Sue Jones with her sideways look at helium. And finally, you just heard James Grosswiner from the Rochdale Herald, the satire website. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online, that's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national volunteering site where you can volunteer for all sorts of things on do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. On today's program, we address the rise of political protests early in the Donald Trump presidency with focus on the most recent incidents at UC Berkeley, where the provocative far-right Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos' speech was canceled after mass protests erupted on campus. Historian, journalist, and San Francisco Chronicle columnist David Talbot joins the conversation. Later in the program, Arif Humayun, the author of Connivance by Silence, a co-founder and president of Circle of Peace and a fellow at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, joins the program to talk about his work, which is dedicated to understanding what causes radicalization and advancing human rights. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. In this segment of the program today, we are going to be discussing the recent activities that have taken place around the country in protests surrounding the presidency of Donald Trump. But more specifically, we're going to be looking at incidents that took place at the University of California, Berkeley, where the provocative far-right Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos, his speech was canceled after mass protests erupted on campus. And for the first segment here today, we're joined by historian and San Francisco Chronicle columnist David Talbot to talk about these issues and the many different approaches and dialogue that we're seeing built around these kind of responses, these protests, violence versus nonviolence, and so forth. So here's my co-host Peter Phillips to introduce David to you. Peter?
David Talbot is a longtime San Franciscan journalist and author. His book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles of the CIA, The Rise of America's Secret Government, was a New York Times bestseller. David was founding pioneer on the news site Salon and was editor of the San Francisco Examiner and has published the New York Times, The Guardian, and The New Yorker. His columns run now three times a week at the San Francisco Chronicle. David, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, David Talbot, you have been active on social media, on your Facebook page, talking about the recent incidents at the University of California, Berkeley, where there was mass resistance and protest that did involve what appeared to be some degrees of violence or setting of fires, these types of things that ultimately ended up leading the university to cancel a talk by Breitbart.com writer Milo Yiannopoulos. And Milo has been in the news for some time for various types of very provocative behavior, trolling behavior online and so forth. So he evokes quite a visceral response in people wherever he goes. But David Talbot, could you wade us into this subject and then we'll have a conversation about the many different perspectives and interpretations?
Well, there's a lively debate already on the left about the reaction to Milo Yiannopoulos and specifically the Berkeley protests, which, as you say, shut him down. Many people who believe in the pure free speech, including some veterans of Berkeley's famous free speech movement, who recently wrote an article in the Daily Cal, the student newspaper at Berkeley, criticizing the protesters for shutting down Yiannopoulos on free speech grounds. I disagree with that because I believe, unfortunately, we're not living in a liberal democracy anymore. We're not living in the sort of civics class version of America that we were taught, where the free for all of discourse and free expression somehow arrives at a position of reason and justice. Unfortunately, we live, I think, in a pre-fascist or emerging fascist society at this point. And someone like Milo Yiannopoulos should not just be seen as some ordinary private citizen or public figure. He, in fact, as a prominent editor and the most prominent face of Breitbart News, essentially function as a front man for the semi-official propaganda arm of the administration of the Trump presidency, which, of course, is essentially run by the former chief executive of Breitbart News, Steve Bannon. So this was an effort to shut down hate speech. That's the way I see it. This is a young man who, for his own narcissistic, self-promotional, vain reasons, goes around stirring up hatred and vilifying our most vulnerable members of our society, writing articles excusing slavery and so on, you know, mocking the weakest and most vulnerable, and inviting their victimization. Well, that's hate speech. And in many advanced democracies like Germany that have unfortunate historic lessons taught them, this kind of speech is not defined as free speech. It's precluded from those constitutional protections. And I believe that given the perilous state that this country is in now, the country that's flying apart by the hour, literally, that's fragmenting our civil society because of this extremist presidency, this extremist government that has taken over, that we are no longer in the kind of privileged position of holding on to these niceties and norms of the past. As I say, we're fighting an emerging fascist government, and in that case, we have to counter hate speech as militantly as we can. Now, that doesn't mean I endorse violence. And the black bloc, so-called black bloc, anarchistic sort of street, you know, wild in the street stuff that happens in Berkeley is wrong, because it only is counterproductive and it invites further repression and it isolates protesters from the rest of the country.
David, can I jump in here? Because that would be great to follow up that subject of black bloc and violence when and if it is ever appropriate. But we can speak about that in a moment. But to address, this is Michael here, to address your issue about the country coming apart and whether this is a moment to challenge fascist, proto-fascist, Nazi-type forces, nip them in the bud before they get a chance to air their views and before a guy like Milo gets to stand up before hundreds of people and air his toxic views. I really agree with you on that. I do think it is a moment when people need to come out and hit fire with fire and punch hard the way Trump has solidly been punching the last several weeks that he's been in office. What's interesting is that throughout Trump's campaigns and all of his rallies, anyone who voiced dissent or any even protester who showed up was either booed or, more often, physically threatened, thrown out, and Trump made the actual point, punch this guy in the nose, get this guy out of here. That was a hallmark of Trump's entire presidential campaign, which freaked the press out and freaked America out that this is a guy running for president who openly declares, kick this guy, beat him up, get him out of here if he dissents. So isn't that ironic? And, you know, of course, the right-wing press now picks this story up as heart of the free speech movement, Berkeley, you know, censoring free speech. But really, this is just using basically Trump tactics back on his people. You see it as something like that?
Yeah. I mean, look, hate speech is not free. It comes with a steep cost, because they're victims often of free speech, as we again have seen historically, not just in Germany, in Rwanda. The mass slaughter of 500,000 human beings in Rwanda took place only after a media campaign that was launched by the ruling elite on the radio stations and other media throughout Rwanda, telling the people of Rwanda to turn on each other and to start butchering each other. That was an example of what can happen when you have the kind of madness that's now set in motion in this country if you allow this kind of thing to go rampant. It has to be opposed by more civilized people up to the point of violence. As I say, I don't agree with the violent reaction to violent speech, but I do believe that it should be militantly opposed, and everything short of sort of the black bloc stuff that happened in Berkeley, I support. Loud chanting, stomping, people who circle a building and prevent Milo Yiannopoulos' idiotic fans from filing into the building to listen to him? Yes. Why should a propagandist for this extremist, abnormal presidency be allowed to keep spewing his poison all around the country, including our own communities? Libertarians, civil liberty advocates, I understand their position. I myself, as a journalist, have held to these positions and these principles throughout my life. But now that I see, actually, from my own studies. As a scholar, I wrote this book, as you said earlier, about Alan Dulles, a man who, through his own dark behavior as one of our key national security figures, injected some of this fascist poison into our country. You see how this kind of poison can grow if it's not countered with the same kind of force that these people injected into our nation's bloodstream.
Hi, this is Peter Phillips. Steve Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos are buddies. They work together. So hate speech coming onto our campuses and coordinated with the government really needs to be repressed, and not violently, but strongly opposed. How do you feel about people going up and spraying pepper spray on folks that are trying to go hear Milo speak?
Well, again, I would draw the line at that. I think that is violent when you assault, you know, someone who you disagree with. Blocking them, though, through linked arms, the chain of human protesters, I think that's legitimate. But assault, no, that's not legitimate.
And we don't necessarily know that that wasn't provocateurs doing the assault.
It's not legitimate, whoever did it.
Correct.
And that's the problem, of course, with the people who, when they start wearing masks and they're incognito, who are they? Are they people who are genuinely outraged, like most of us, by Trump policies, or are they police agents who are trying to stir things up and create a pretext for further repression? This has happened, unfortunately, throughout the history of protests in this country, and I'm sure many people out there listening to us, including myself, are old enough to remember back to the 60s and 70s when government routinely infiltrated protest movements with provocateurs, and that's their game, to stir things up and then create a pretext for further crackdowns. I mean, look, these people in the Trump White House now are just itching for the next Reichstag fire of their administration.
Or 9/11, David Talbot, because that was also a president that didn't win the popular vote, that had sagging ratings, George W. Bush, and then 9/11 catapulted him into political stardom momentarily and certainly kicked off the so-called war on terror.
Right, and the way that the Trump administration is goading hour by hour the Muslim population, not only of this country, but of the entire world, you can only pray that we don't have another terror incident anytime soon. But as soon as we do, yes, you can imagine how they're going to exploit it and ratchet up the kind of madness that they've already been escalating in this country. So we live in such dangerous times now. People are being killed for their religious beliefs, for their race, because of their race, because of their political views. They're being threatened, they're being bullied, they're being targeted, and in many cases by the sort of Milos of the world who go after progressives and people they disagree with in all sorts of extreme ways. And so that's why I say we're not living in a civics textbook world anymore. We're living in a pre-fascist or emerging fascist America. And so my fellow liberals and libertarians who are concerned about pure free speech and protecting that, I understand those concerns. But as I say, unfortunately, that's not the world we live in anymore.
Well, David Talbot, that's exactly where I want to go next. The statement from administrators at UC Berkeley said, quote, "We condemn in the strongest possible terms the violence and unlawful behavior that was on display and deeply regret that those tactics will now overshadow the efforts to engage in legitimate and lawful protest against the performers' presence and perspectives. While Yiannopoulos' views, tactics, and rhetoric are profoundly contrary to our own, we are bound by the Constitution, the law, our values, and the campus's principles of community to enable free expression across the full spectrum of opinion and perspective." And I want to add to that, the statement from the Foundation of Individual Rights in Education, where Greg Lukianoff is head, the legal group that protects free speech and academic freedom on campuses, their statement was the following, quote, "The use of mob violence to respond to constitutionally protected expression is an affront to our nation's liberal traditions, and as so often happens, it has also proven deeply counterproductive, sabotaging its apparent aim. Instead of silencing Yiannopoulos, the violent response ensured that his message was broadcast nationwide." In other words, David Talbot, I would suggest, and I'm making simply an argument, and it's certainly here for all of us to disagree with or however we see it, but censorship backfires. And this is playing right into the playbook of Breitbart, of David Horowitz, where they go and they purposely are provocative. You see now that not only is Yiannopoulos alone, he is with Scarelli, the big pharma guy, right? Remember? So this is like a 1-2 punch of, you know, really toxic, as Michael Levithan said, kind of rhetoric in your face that is bringing these kinds of visceral responses, and maybe rightfully so. But then they're turning around and Yiannopoulos immediately plays the victim card. And this is what David Horowitz has long done. You remember David back from Ramparts, now, of course, far right, front page mag, etc. Another Breitbart kind of thing, far right wing, quote unquote, news outlet. But what are your thoughts about that kind of a perspective on the free speech spectrum, which I know you're also riffing on from the free speech movement on some of the recent posts?
Well, look, liberals and progressives can't win. When they're nice and play by the rules, which unfortunately is all too often the case, like the Democrats in Washington until maybe recently, let's see, we're called wimps and losers and so on. And we are when we play by those nice rules, I believe. And when we're overly aggressive, of course, oh, my God, the world is caving in and we're the mob, the unruly mob and all that. But look, these people are ruthless. Our opponents are ruthless people. If we don't get that at this point, then we've got our heads stuck in the sand. These people are out to destroy us. They're out to destroy everything that we hold dear in this country. And if we don't fight back, tooth and nail, fight fire with fire, then we are the losers and the wimps that these people have called us for years. Now, again, there's limits to what you can do and should do. And I've said that very clearly. And so, yes, when the Black Bloc goes wild in the streets, they're off on their own kind of crazy mission. And they should be excluded and separated in whatever ways we can from the more peaceful but very militant opposition. My dream protest would have been everything short of what the Black Bloc did. Encircling the building, chanting loudly, disrupting, making it all but impossible for that occasion to go on. Yes, I'm all for that. Because this is a poison that must be stopped, and we must stop it by taking the gloves off, but not through violence. I know that's a very difficult line to draw, but we have to do it. We have to do it if we're going to save this country.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're also joined by the Project Censored Radio Program's new senior correspondent, Michael Levitin, who's been doing numerous segments with us. We thank Michael Levitin for joining us on the program. And we're speaking with journalist and author David Talbot. So we're going to continue this conversation about recent events with Milo Yiannopoulos, about the protests against the so-called alt-right or neo-fascist movements. We'll continue that after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin, and we are joined in conversation with author and journalist David Talbot, and we're talking about the massive protests that have been following Milo Yiannopoulos, the Breitbart writer, around the country, recently at UC Berkeley and before that UC Davis. So, Peter Phillips?
I think, David, to bring your point forward here, that we're really at a state of fascism, really, at 3:13 a.m. on February 2nd, Donald Trump tweets, "If UC Berkeley does not allow free speech and practices violence on innocent people with a different point of view, no federal funds." Now, whenever has a president made that kind of a comment on an event happening somewhere in the country? So we have to look at this as a coordinated effort, and certainly one that we have to stand up to. Are you surprised by Trump's tweet?
No, of course not. He's a bully fascist, and that's what bully fascists do, particularly when their own little Hitler youth, Milo Yiannopoulos, gets rushed off campus because we're starting to finally fight back the way we should be. This is what's going to be happening. This is the new norm. This kind of level of combat is what the new America is all about. We have to be prepared for this and gird our loins, and we're in this for the long haul. I just heard about this new call for a general strike, a work stoppage, a national general strike on Friday, February 17th. I heartily endorse those ideas. Francine Crowes, the noted writer, raised this in an article in The Guardian, and I believe that we have to use all sorts of means that are very unusual for most Americans. The way I put it is this: if our government has become the enemy, and it clearly has, then we must become ungovernable.
David, picking up on your point about the Hitler Youth, as you say, Milo is sort of a representative, something, you know, channeling from last century. I think you could extend that and say that if the forces did not come out right now to challenge Milo and challenge Breitbart and the entire false media narrative, the alternative fact universe they live in, and physically come into the streets to challenge them, I think you wouldn't be far off in envisioning that Trump himself would call out his own red shirts at some point. And we can probably expect that anyway to happen, whether people resist at this moment or not. We're not so far off of Trump calling on his huge, his so-called giant base of support, though he lost the popular vote by 3 million people. He does consider himself, and he is a man with millions of supporters around the country. It's not unrealistic to think that at some point in the near future, to get policies rammed through despite incredible protest and mass resistance, we're talking, you know, trying to revive the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline and the immense swells of population and protesters and youth and everybody that will be out to reject that. This is kind of a come to Jesus moment, and there's going to probably be more violence than we expect. I wouldn't be surprised if he brings his own minions out and calls out his own red hat, red shirt boys into the streets. So do you see this as maybe preempting? And it really is mirroring Weimar Germany, 1930s Germany, when you had the socialists and the communists in the streets marching against the fascists. It really is a lead up in a sense. But right now, it seems with these protests on university campuses, at least in California, this side, the left, is getting out in front of the aggressive forces of the right that are not yet in the street.
Well, yes, it does call to mind Weimar Germany, I agree, and the sort of street fighting between Hitler's brown shirt and the communists and the socialists and the red shirts. That didn't end well, as we know. Hitler used that street violence and that growing sense of anarchy to, of course, you know, feed on people's fears, the German public's fears, and further consolidate his power. And we have to be concerned about that. Unfortunately, at this point, because he's now the commander-in-chief, he doesn't need his street army. He has the official army, National Guard, and so on. He has enormous repressive power, and he will not stop short of using it. We can be sure of that. That's why I do say I draw the line at violence. You know, I can understand why people really get off on it when a white nationalist pig like Richard Spencer is slugged in the face on the streets of Washington, as he was during Inauguration Week, by a Black Bloc guy.
Or someone dressed like a Black Bloc guy.
Or someone dressed as a Black Bloc guy. I'm sure that felt good to a lot of people, and for obvious reasons. But the problem is that violence starts to spiral, and it can lead, and usually does, to a very dangerous place. So my feeling is, no. Get militant and get mobilized, but stop short of that. And it's the masses of people in the streets. It's the people who are refusing to take orders. It's the people disrupting and sabotaging and undermining this extremist president rule. That's the way we're going to win. We're going to make this country ungovernable in nonviolent ways. And that's what's going to bring him down.
But don't you think, another thought, just really to point in, David, one thing that struck as well and came to mind, everyone's reviving the 60s and all these sort of hallmark moments, including the free speech movement, but it came to mind seeing the fire at the campus, seeing the broken windows, and seeing that true violence, as in gunshot violence, may not be far off. It brought to mind Kent State, and wondering more than, Mickey, your point about, you know, what's Trump's 9/11 going to be? What's Trump's Kent State going to be when we have not had in decades a moment in which young people out protesting peacefully get gunned down, get killed? That would shock the American public, and yet it almost feels as though that time may not be far off, because things are escalating so quickly and people are so outraged and in face of they're resisting.
Part of canceling this, and the university delayed in canceling it, over 100 faculty members had sent a letter to the chancellor almost a month ago where they cited Yiannopoulos as, when he visited the University of Wisconsin in December, he spoke at his public lecture about a transgender student at the university in derogatory ways. It went so far as to project a picture of this person on the lecture, and at the same time it was broadcast on Breitbart. That is hate speech no matter what. He does not deserve a stage on a public university.
I'm concerned, as you say, about what this administration is capable of, given already his judicial appointments, Trump's. I mean, Jeff Sessions is an extremist who should never have been allowed anywhere near the Justice Department. The man who's now been nominated for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch. We just learned that when he was a preppy at Georgetown Prep School, one of the most elite prep schools in the nation in Washington, he was the president and founder of a student club called Fascism Forever. I mean, these are the kind of, like, bizarre and extreme people that this administration is filling up its positions with. And so, again, we do not live in normal times. We have to understand that. I know it's difficult for people. We're all still sort of, like, stupefied, I think, by the events of the past 2 weeks. But we have to absorb the new reality and take the proper steps at this point.
You know, David Talbot, the reason I think Michael Levitin brought up the Kent State issue, there are so many different things that I wanted to spin off of, but I don't want to get off the topic here. But just riffing on that one thread there, definitely we're seeing mass unrest, and we have already been seeing mass violence used against protests, against Native Americans, against activists and other protesters, and that was under Obama. We have been seeing this for years. We saw it against Occupy Wall Street. We're seeing it all over. So it isn't as if there's no precedent for it, and we don't need to go all the way back to Kent State for that. We already seem, I'm going to use this term again, we already seem to be at some level of fever pitch here in the so-called Trump era. It seems that it's kind of a tinderbox, something like what happened recently at UC Berkeley and before at UC Davis, and what's kind of following people like Milo and Breitbart around, which I think is what they want, is the spectacle. Right. And they can control this narrative that the left is intolerant and so forth. But I think we're nearing tinderbox moments. What do you think?
Well, exactly. That's why I say it's not just like crying fire in a crowded theater at this point, this kind of hate speech. It's like setting fire to the theater. We are about to blow. Look, even the press guy, Sean Spicer, who's supposed to be the kind of guy who goes out and sort of, you know, makes nice on the press and smooth things over. This guy is like, the new article in the New Yorker just said, he's like a fire hydrant ready to blow.
He's a pit bull.
Yeah. And so there are no new norms. The new norm is scary. That's what we're saying. And I agree that we've seen sort of the levels of repression being ratcheted up even under Obama. I was at Standing Rock. It was a war scene. It was a battleground. I mean, the level of militarized violence there against peaceful protesters was just terrifying.
Now there will be multiple pipeline projects, Keystone being more gigantic in its scope as a pipeline, and the thousands and upon thousands and thousands of people, young people, everyone, and indigenous and families and everyone is going to go out. And will this mean they will need a new level of courage to go because this is Trump, not Obama, who has a kind of a final order?
Well, I think that's true, Michael. We will need a new level of courage because we are at war. We are now warriors. You know, one of the saddest things about Standing Rock when I was up there was to see all these veterans, these military veterans who were Native American, who had returned from the battlefields of Afghanistan and Iraq, suffering from PTSD still. And when they saw the helicopters and the Humvees and the kind of like militarized presence that was being directed at them, a lot of them started to go into PTSD shock and have to be treated in the medic tents there. So, yeah, we are at war, and there are going to be casualties, and we've seen this already. There were a number of casualties at Standing Rock. And now with this president, and, of course, Obama did a timeout near the end of his administration, and we are able to take a breather, but not anymore. Standing Rock is now ground zero, and there'll be many more.
And it seems like there may be more and more, as you say, ground zeros, particularly following around Breitbart and others, particularly with Steve Bannon in the White House, seemingly supporting, possibly even orchestrating these talks, or certainly cheering them on with Milo Yiannopoulos and others. So, David Talbot, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. I know you do a lot of this writing on Facebook. Is there anywhere you could tell listeners where they could read more of you in addition to the San Francisco Chronicle?
I post my San Francisco Chronicle column on my Facebook page, because you know, Mickey, because you're in there, as a very lively forum where
Indeed.
A lot of these ideas are being thrashed out by the hour. So I invite everyone to come in there.
Thanks so much, David Talbot. Thanks for joining us for this important conversation. It's going to be an ongoing one, and we'll certainly be bringing you back onto the Project Censored show to discuss these things.
My pleasure.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. In the next segment of the program, we're joined by Arif Humayun, author of Connivance by Silence. Stay with us.
Peace train sounding louder. Ride on the peace train. Come on, the peace train. It's peace train home. Even go a little bit. Good friends too, cause it's getting nearer. It's a simple deal with you. Come and join the living. It's not the fault of you. And it's getting nearer. Soon it will all be through. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Arif Humayun is an American citizen, practicing Muslim, and an avid writer. He specializes in comparative religion and has dedicated to understanding what causes radicalism in advancing human rights. He was born in Pakistan, came to the United States in 1980. He's lived all over the world. His newest book is Connivance by Silence, addresses the politically inspired inspirations of Islam that has crept into the Muslim discourse and inspired radicalism. Arif is also the president and co-founder of the Circle of Peace, an international initiative to strengthen the bonds of humanity and compassion across faith communities. He's a fellow in the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and is an active member of the American Islamic Leadership Coalition. Welcome, Arif.
Thank you.
You write in your book that radical extremism, what Trump is pledging to destroy, is a stain on Islam. And is wholly contrary to the proper teachings of Islam and should, in fact, be eliminated by Muslims themselves. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that idea?
Yes, this Islamic radical ideology, this needs to be tackled by Muslims themselves because this is, as you said, a stain on the religion. And let me just give you a very short introduction of the purpose of religion as Muslims understand it. The purpose of religion is to transform human beings, us, from the instinctive stage, which is the very basic stage of humans, to a moral stage where we can differentiate between right and wrong and do justice. And then the ultimate stage is the spiritual stage, where we really don't care about ourselves but care about the society, about other people, and so forth. So the whole teachings of Islam, it's a very simple and very modern religion. The five pillars of Islam are affirmation of the faith, that there's only one God and Muhammad is his messenger, five obligatory prayers a day, fasting for the month of Ramadan, a charity and pilgrimage to Mecca. And if you look at this, these are, I think, are training tools for the individual to achieve the purpose of the faith that I described earlier. Affirmation is a commitment. The five prayers, daily prayers, are essentially a discipline, cleanliness, and humility. Fasting is more of the same. And charity on 2.5% of your wealth to help the poor, this is essentially a bigger sacrifice and being part of the society and helping the disadvantaged people. And the pilgrimage is nothing more than a message of unity and equality, because everybody is dressed the same and they all do the same things, irrespective of if somebody is rich or poor, black or white or whatever. And then the other part of the Muslim faith are the six articles of faith, which essentially are belief in one God and all the angels. And the angels that Muslims believe in are the same as biblical angels. And belief in all the prophets. And while we don't know all the names of all the prophets, Muslims believe that there were 124,000 plus prophets around the world and sent to all people at all times. And belief in all the revealed books, and five of them are mentioned in the Quran, Scrolls of Abraham, the book of Moses called Torah, Psalms of David, Gospel of Jesus, and the Quran that came down on Prophet Muhammad.
and predestination, that the people will be born, they'll die, and then there's life after death. But in between the birth and death, we have to use a gray matter to understand what's going on and how to conduct ourselves. That's essentially what religion is. But notice that the topics of jihad, sharia, blasphemy, apostasy are all missing in the teachings of the faith. These are all made up by the radical ideology, which is a politicized version of religion that was essentially propagated about 100 years ago after the First World War. And just to move on to the agenda of the Islamists, their whole objective is to create an Islamic state, create an Islamic caliphate, a political caliphate, and this is based on the foundations of Sharia, which essentially is a law that gives them power to control people's behavior. Jihad is a violent interpretation that they have created themselves. Apostasy, that restricts people's freedom to choose, and blasphemy, which restricts people's freedom of expression. So that is the Islamist agenda. And if you need, I can elaborate further on the differences between religion and the political interpretation. Islam is not a political message. It is for individuals to transform themselves and society, for establishing peace in the society based on freedoms and morality. It promotes piety and also creates an environment for peace, equality, and justice. The radical interpretation, on the other hand, promotes their ideology as a political system, and they claim they have a solution to every conceivable problem, but that has to be determined by the politicized clergy. No, people like you and I cannot do that. And the goal is to establish the Islamic State, which I just described, and they promote religiosity and not piety, and they enforce religious practices and have severe punishments for what they deem to be crimes, but those things are essentially sanctioned by the faith.
Ernie, you describe what the history of jihad and that that wasn't necessarily violent. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, jihad in the scripture allows a defensive war only, and that is not only to protect the Islamic faith, but for all religions. But there are three different forms of jihad, the lowest one being a defensive war. The higher forms of jihad is a jihad against our own egos. That is what is preferred. In fact, there's one tradition that the Prophet is telling his followers that we are going from a minor jihad, which was a defensive war, to a greater jihad, that means against our own egos and against our own selves, to overcome anger and greed and those sort of things, and to help transform us into a better human being so we can help the society that we are in.
You write about the 1.5 billion Muslims in the world and that a very small percentage are radical extremists.
Yes.
But they've gotten a huge amount of attention and have been in some cases encouraged, certainly by the U.S. in Afghanistan against Russia. So what responsibility do the 1.5 billion Muslims have to sort of weed out the radicals?
Each one of us Muslims has responsibility to reject this ideology. And the problem that I see is that the Muslim world is largely uneducated or very low levels of education. And education does not mean going to school and college, but it means to be able to decipher the information and make choices between what they consider right and wrong. The Muslim world is primarily busy with this religiosity. They would dress up in a certain way, which is largely cultural. They would speak in a different way, in a certain way, and just memorize information that they get, but not be critical of what they are being told. And the source of information for many in the Muslim world, most of them live in the third world countries, is through the cleric in the mosque or through local print media, which has to cater to whatever the audiences are. So I think each of us has to understand what the faith is. And also I would mention that while the scripture is in Arabic, it's old classical Arabic, there are many translations and many commentaries available. And the quality of the translation and the quality of the commentary depends on the knowledge of the translator or the commentator. The translations have no major issues, but when it goes into commentary, then some of the commentaries I've seen, they are just nothing more than fairy tales. I mean, they just go into different areas to make the point, And at times, they are just wrong. And that is where many people get their ideas from. And they don't look at other people's interpretations, and they just limit themselves to the one interpretation and close their mind in a way. And just to give you an example, there's one place in the Quran which talks about locking fire in stone. The common interpretation of that was meant to be flint. But now we know radioactivity, we know uranium, we know all these materials, so that could be another meaning of the same words. And another place related to this is that they talk about a fire that burns from the inside, does not affect the outside. And nuclear radiation could also be inferred from that. So this is how the meaning of the Quran changes over time. The words stay the same, but based on our own knowledge, we can extend the understanding. But people limit themselves to the old translation, whatever they're used to, and that is one of the problems. If you look at the religion of Islam, there are many sects, about 6 dozen sects within them. Each one of them says that they have monopoly over the faith. They are right, everybody else is wrong. The same is true with other faiths, but I'm just talking about Islam here. So we have to get out of those silos that we are in and just look at the big picture and then understand what we are supposed to be doing. And just in terms of the violence that we see, the Quran talks about killing one innocent individual to be like killing the entire humankind, and saving one innocent life as saving the entire humankind. So this is the extent of compassion and the extent of value of human life in Islam. Yet the terrorists or radical people, they just kill indiscriminately and just justify their actions by whatever word they use.
So you're saying that terrorism is certainly contrary to Islam and the Quran and morally wrong?
Absolutely.
We're speaking with Arif Humayun, author of Connivance by Silence. He is a co-founder and president of the Circle of Peace, and he joins us today on the Project Censored show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. So, Arif, can you talk a little bit more specifically about strategies of nonviolence? Is that playing a role here in what you're dealing with, and can you talk more about how you manifest this?
The strategies for nonviolence, I mean, they were demonstrated by the Prophet himself. For example, first of all, when he migrated from his birthplace called Mecca to another place called Medina, which is about 200 miles away, he was invited there to help the other tribes, which were pagan and Christian and Jewish tribes, to resolve their feuds. So he came up with what is commonly known as the Constitution of Medina, which essentially reads like a Nero Charter. I mean, it talks about collective defense. Nobody is forced to change the faith. Nobody required to do anything different other than give up the feuds, the long feuds and revenge, and give up bloodshed. That is all that was required. And they agreed for collective defense. There was no Sharia at that time. That is more important. So that is one example. The other example is that after he had come back to Mecca, and he came back to Mecca with 10,000 people, and not one single person was killed in combat in that operation. And in his last sermon, he told the gathering that everybody is equal. All men are equal, and black, white, or yellow, or brown does not make any difference. And he said that God has made the life, property, and honor of every man sacred. And in fact, he did say that to take any man's life or his property or to attack his honor is unjust and wrong. I mean, this is a very strong statement he made. And he also said that men and women have equal rights. And the other interesting thing I'd like to tell you is that in 1964, I believe, there was a book published that cross-referenced every article of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted in 1948, to the Quran. And yet, the sad part is that about 1990, the OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, many of the members had signed this declaration, but in 1990, they turned around and said this declaration is against Islam because it does not include Sharia. And they adopted another declaration, which is referred to as the Cairo Declaration. And so this is the irony of things, that in 64, the people are saying every article is consistent, and in 1990, they are turning around and saying this is not Islamic. So what do you do about such things? And OIC is a 56 or 57 member group of Muslim countries, which is led by Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And Pakistan did sign the declaration in 1948. So this is the issue that we are dealing with.
Harif, you describe in your book as Pakistan being kind of the center of radical Islam, and it's branched out from there, but certainly had its role in the war in Afghanistan when Russia was involved. And now we have Trump pledging to destroy radical Islam, banning immigrants from the seven countries of the world, mostly Islamic, that we are bombing. Is that a provocation that will continue to create a challenge to Muslims worldwide?
It certainly is, because force cannot change minds or ideologies. And just going back to your question, the radical ideology started out in Egypt in 1928, after the Ottoman Empire was defeated in the First World War, and the Muslim Brotherhood raised the demand of having an Islamic State. The Ottoman Empire was considered to be an Islamic State, despite the fact that there were two other states which existed. One was in India, a Mughal Empire, and the other one was in Iran. But because of the caliphate, which had become political by that time, Turkey was regarded as the Islamic State. And I would say for wrong reasons. But anyway, when the Turks were defeated, or prior to the defeat, the caliphate, Ottoman caliphate, sent emissaries out to the Muslim world. And one guy came to India as well. This is before the partition into India and Pakistan. And they sought support from the people so that they would preserve the caliphate. But when Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, he took over, he abolished the caliphate. But that had started a movement in India in which even Gandhi participated, because Gandhi's goal was, this is the founder of India, Mahatma Gandhi, his goal was to unite Hindus and Muslims. But that backfired, and that alienated the people, and also caused this radical ideology to sink in. But then at about the same time, because India was also trying to get rid of the British colonizers at that time, there was another individual who was a journalist, but he became a scholar and a leader and formed a political party. He also picked up on the demand for the Islamic State, and he, in fact, justified jihad as justified the use of force under jihad to create the Islamic State, and his name was Maulana Maududi, and his party is essentially responsible for this ideology to creep into Pakistan. But there are other events and divided India. I should also mention those. The clergy was opposed to the partition of India for whatever reason. After the country was partitioned, these guys had no need to be in India, so they came back to Pakistan and pledged to serve the religion and not take part in politics. And they disrupted the first Constituent Assembly's proceedings, because the question they were debating was whether they should adopt the parliamentary form of government or the presidential form. And the question that was being discussed was, should president be sovereign or the prime minister? These guys said God can be sovereign and no human can be sovereign. So that derailed the process. And then the parliament adopted a compromise resolution, commonly known as the objective resolution, saying that all laws framed in the country will conform to Islam. That is now part of the constitution. But that is a slippery slope because of the division between the people. If one party were to frame a law, the others would claim this is un-Islamic. So the parliament is essentially paralyzed for making any meaningful legislation in that country.
So radicalism fits into that ideology that we're going to follow the laws of God, the states can decide that.
Yes.
And then that can run counter to, like, human rights.
Absolutely.
And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was not accepted by Sharia law, is that correct?
Well, the Sharia law is also very interesting. Let me describe how it came around. The Sharia law we're talking about is not in the Quran. This is legislative Sharia that was developed by the Abbasid Caliphate back in the 8th and 9th century. Abbasid Caliphate was a very large country, and it had all sorts of people, and it was expanding its boundaries. So they wanted to have a unified law which they could apply across to the entire population. But the other important thing to remember is that it was not a static law. They hired scholars to frame the law. They asked them to consult the Quran and then come up with the law, but they could not do it. So Then they started looking at other sources, and about 200 years after the Prophet's death, they started compiling what he did or what he may have done or what he may have said. And some of those stories they collected were genuine, but some of them were not. And so then they looked at whatever they had. They still could not frame the law. And then they started using precedents and analogy and reasoning to frame the law, using the principles of the Quran, which were equality, peace, and justice. And it was a dynamic system, because at any time there were multiple interpretations of what came out. Because today there are four major schools of thought in the Sunni Islam. At that time there were about two or three dozen schools of thought, and each one of them contested the decisions or the choices. So it was an ever-changing set of laws which was updated regularly to cater to the changing environment, social and cultural. But the foundation had to be on justice, peace, and equality. But the other important thing is that the Abbasid Caliphate was a collection of many independent entities who paid homage to them. So there was inbuilt separation of framing the law by the Caliphate and its implementation by the independent political entities that existed under them. But in today's case, the demands of these radical clergy is that they would frame the law and they would implement it themselves, which is, again, something that is not good.
Arif, in your book, Connivance by Silence, you're implying that Muslims worldwide are not stepping up to the plate, so to speak, in regards of challenging radical Islam, challenging Sharia law in a more direct, open way, and that the religion itself offers great hope for individuals to make their own moral choices following the pillars that you talked about of the faith. So what is your prescription here? What should people be doing? What should Muslims be doing actively today in the world?
My suggestion to my co-religionists and friends is that they should understand the faith themselves and not rely on people's interpretation. And the simplest thing is to look at the multiple explanations, multiple translations and commentaries around them, and just see what fits in the modern system that we live in. The bigger thing that we have not done, the Muslims have not done, is that they could not transform their economies and intellect from the agrarian system that the Sharia law grew in back in the time of the Abbasid Caliphate. Today we are living in an industrial age, so we haven't transformed our thinking from that agrarian to the industrial era, and that is where the shortcoming is. But that is nothing to do with the faith. I think each individual, and my own example, I was transferred to Australia, and that's where somebody challenged me about my faith, and I had knew nothing about my faith. I was born in the Muslim faith, but I went to a Catholic school. So then I started understanding, searching on my own. This is back in 1989, and then I started researching, understanding my faith, and that's how I started, you know, these things, to write about these things, explain them to other people. So I guess the Muslims have to critically understand, review the faith, and see how it fits with the radical interpretation. And many people would, on a private level, reject it. But the issue is that the laws in Muslim countries are so restrictive, they do not allow condemnation of these ideologies, and that's called blasphemy. I mean, if you look at people who have raised their voices against these unjust ideologies, they are murdered, to the extent that the governor of the largest province in Pakistan, he made a comment that the blasphemy law needs to be revised. His guard killed him, point-blank range. And after a lot of political maneuvering, his guard was convicted. The judge that convicted him had to leave the country, and then he was hanged. And now they've built a big mausoleum for him, and people are coming and donating, making big financial donations, and they want to start a madrasa. And this is in the capital of Pakistan, Islamabad. So this is the extent of suppression of expression, and this is not helping anybody, just helping the clergy. This is bread and butter for them, so they don't want to give up. It's a very, very serious situation. I think what we have to do is, sitting here, we can discuss these things freely and promote human rights and equal rights for everybody, so people can speak up. I'm concerned about the future generation. If they don't get this message, they would be locked into the same silos that the previous generations are, and they might not be able to look at the big picture. And this is not going to help the Muslims at all. We have to be open and discuss them openly and in a positive, objective manner.
Arif Humayun, you are also a co-founder and president of the Circle of Peace. You're a fellow at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. We have a few minutes left here, and I just wanted to have you have the opportunity to tell the listeners about what you do in those capacities.
The Circle of Peace is a grassroots movement. It started out after I wrote a rather lengthy white paper on radicalism back, I think it was 2006 or 7, when the terrorists attacked the hotels in India, in Bombay. I stayed at those places. In fact, my wife and I were there that summer when the attack occurred. So I wrote this lengthy paper and distributed it as far as I could. And there was a Christian priest in our city who saw this, and he talked to me about it. Then he brought a Jewish guy, and he said, this is the sort of information that we have not seen before. So we, four or five of us, got together and formed a Circle of Peace. So we do discuss these difficult topics and publish on these topics, and our website has all the publications. We also hold seminars annually where we invite different faith groups to come and talk to a common topic from the scriptures. So we don't say who is good or bad, but we just talk about the topic. Like, for example, our next seminar is on the 13th of February at George Fox University, and that's going to talk about building bridges through education. And we have a Jewish rabbi, a Buddhist Christian, and a Muslim speaker talking about what our religion requires us to do to promote education and build bridges with other people. So that's essentially what we do. Have a website.
Could you give the website?
www.circleofpeaceonline.org.
Thank you so much, Arif Humayun. Your work, Connivance of Silence, thank you so much for your taking time out of your day for a discussion to share this work, and important work in your trying to understand radicalization and also advance human rights. Thanks for joining the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you very much.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interests who set fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. Thank you for joining us today. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Also, come visit and see what we do online at www.projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness.
What climate change data can tell us about the emergence and spread of diseases. On January 24, 2017, Marketplace, the American Public Media radio program, reported that the Center for Disease Control abruptly canceled a long-scheduled climate summit. It was set to take place in February in Atlanta.
A conference to discuss climate change hurting public health is off, at least for now. The Centers for Disease Control began notifying participants of an indefinite postponement late last month. Some see an early change in the political winds when it comes to climate. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jed Kim reports.
With climate change, a lot of attention goes to structural concerns, like the need to deal with rising sea levels. But Regina Shi of the RAND Corporation says there are myriad health effects, too.
Temperature-related death and illness. There are also air quality impacts. We've seen increases in Zika as well as other vector-borne diseases.
plus water-related sickness, food security. She's got a long list. It's a lot of things the CDC typically worries about. Howard Frumkin is a former director of the National Center for Environmental Health at the CDC.
This is basic bread-and-butter public health. Anticipate the hazard, understand how the hazard operates, and then protect people. If we pull the plug on that, then people are at risk.
Frumkin's worried politics pushed CDC leadership to cancel its Climate and Health Summit. In a written statement, the agency said it's considering rescheduling, but that it's also considering budget priorities. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
That was the Marketplace Morning Report of January 24, 2017. On the same day, Breitbart News, formerly run by the senior Trump advisor Steve Bannon, wrote, "The CDC cancellation is unquestionably a result of the Trump effect." The CDC is one of many U.S. federal agencies which have been forced rapidly to adjust their priorities. From CDC to NASA to departments from the Interior to Defense, agencies are infiltrated by green entryists from below and encouraged by irresponsible prioritizing from above. They have engaged in climate change activism, which has nothing at all to do with their core mission. And Breitbart News continues, "The CDC is a particularly egregious example of this environmentalist mission creep. Founded in 1946, its job is to protect public health and safety through the control and prevention of disease. What does climate change have to do with this? Nothing. The evidence that man-made climate change is damaging to human health is at best flimsy, at worst fabricated." That was Breitbart News from January 24, 2017. This exchange caught my attention because I had seen research done at the Center for Disease Control and in public health departments at universities that has factored in climate change as cause or multiplier of disease, going back as long as three decades. That research includes data from temperature and sea level rise and increases in carbon dioxide. Matching and mapping these basic data with health data show patterns and opportunities to predict, mitigate, and intervene in order to protect people. Public health has already paid attention and responded to the impact of climate change in heat waves, extreme weather events, air quality, food production, and displacement of peoples. And they consider how climate change affects a large number of diseases that may be accelerated or moved into areas previously free from them, such as malaria, encephalitis, hantavirus, Rift Valley fever, West Nile virus, cholera, and harmful algae blooms in warming waters, and more. That an administration with a constitutional duty to protect the people would challenge or even eliminate one important factor, i.e. climate change, from the research and data collections of various agencies is cause of very serious concern. And that an agency such as the Center for Disease Control would voluntarily cancel a long-planned conference appears as self-censorship. So here, within the next 20 minutes, is a surprising reaction to the cancellation, a brief portrait of an academic with integrity, plus an example of the very recent climate change work by the Public Health Department at the University of Washington. 2 days after the CDC announced that they were canceling their climate change summit, Scientific American wrote, quote, "The conference is now back on, but not at the CDC. Former Vice President Al Gore will instead convene the event on February 16 at the nonprofit Carter Center in Atlanta. It remains unclear, however, whether any governmental scientists will have the courage to attend or speak. As it becomes known who the scientists are who were prevented from speaking, there will be more programming on TUC Radio on public health and climate change. And of course, as the material from the alternate meeting becomes available. The alternate climate and health meeting will be hosted by Dr. Howard Frumkin, a former director of the National Center for Environmental Health at the CDC. Originally, Frumkin had been scheduled to be a speaker at the now-canceled conference. Dr. Frumkin now teaches at the University of Washington. In November 2016, the School of Public Health at the University of Washington hosted an intimate discussion between faculty, staff, and students on a topic of growing importance to public health under the title, When the Next Pandemic Strikes, Are We Ready? Pandemic is an ancient Greek word for all people. It's an epidemic or infectious disease that has spread through human populations across a large region or even worldwide. The first voice you will hear is Sanjay Chheda. He gives a moving definition of public health and also the introduction to Dr. Howard Frumkin.
Good evening. My name is Sanjay Chheda. I'm the vice chair of the School of Public Health's Dean's Council, and I also serve as the school's representative on the UW Foundation Board. So welcome to our third PRISM event, and I think you're really going to enjoy tonight's event. We have a great topic, a very interesting topic about pandemics, when the next pandemic strikes, are we ready? I'd like to just share why I'm so passionate about the School of Public Health and the field in general, why I think it's so interesting and also so important. There's two really distinguishing aspects that I always think about when I'm explaining what public health is to folks. Public health professionals and researchers really look upstream and think about all the things that impact the health of our communities and our society. So public health includes things like the environment, the impact of chemical toxins and pollutants on our health, access to green spaces and how that helps keep us healthy, things like food safety, the food that we consume, the entire supply chain from farms to grocery stores to restaurants. How do we ensure that food that we consume is safe? Things like gun control and how that impacts our health. And the professionals in this field also think about health at a population level. So not just individuals by individuals that we might need to treat in a medical situation, but how do we think about healthiness of groups, of communities, of entire cities. And that's important to me because we're really all in this together. The health of the people around us impacts our own health. And the more we can live in communities where everyone is healthy and can lead productive lives, the better off that we all are. And so that's what really makes this field so important to me. We also live in global communities. And the environmental decisions made far away in India and China and how they produce electricity and how much coal they're burning, that impacts our health. That impacts the entire planet's health. And as a segue to tonight's topic, pandemics, well, they can start anywhere in the world. And with our very interconnected world, where people can be halfway around the world in 8 hours on a flight, they can spread very, very fast. And that's one of the reasons I think that this topic has gained so much prominence or regained prominence recently. We've had pandemic outbreaks of very, very dramatic diseases like Ebola and Zika recently that spread very quickly around the world. So to get into tonight's plan, I'm very pleased and honored to introduce Howie Frumkin, who is my good friend and also served as the Dean of the School of Public Health from 2010 to 2016. So I've worked with Howie extensively on our Dean's Council. From 2005 to 2010, Howie held leadership roles at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. And tonight, Howie is serving in two capacities. First, to give a brief overview of pandemics and what the UW is planning related to preparedness, and then to discuss his work related to global climate change and human health and pandemics. So without further ado, let's welcome Howie to get tonight started.
Well, thank you, Sanjay, and good evening, everybody. I'm so glad to see old friends here, and I'm so glad to see new friends, and I see a few not yet new friends, so I hope to see you afterwards at the dessert session. I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of the whole story of pandemics. The story begins a long time ago. I was going to show you an incredible description from the Peloponnesian Wars by Thucydides, but I decided to go farther back than that and show you this passage from the Bible. It says, "The Lord will strike you with wasting disease, with fever and inflammation, with scorching heat and drought," and so on. This is almost a clinically precise description of a pandemic disease, the kind of thing that swept through populations with who knows what kind of regularity. But it wasn't unknown to the ancients. It was very well known to the Greeks, and it's been a feature of human history ever since. In recent years, pandemic diseases have broken out across the globe. Some of the diseases that have broken out regionally and globally are long-standing diseases such as anthrax and cholera that reemerge, sometimes in new, unfamiliar forms like the multidrug-resistant TB. Others of the diseases that are emerging are brand new, the Mides respiratory syndrome, Zika, things that have only been around for a few decades or even less. HIV might be the best-known example. Look at the density of where these are occurring, and you'll see that we are not immune being in North America. There are lots of outbreaks around the world, but perhaps the densest area is North America. So this truly is a problem of global proportions, and tackling it is both a matter of global health and a matter of local public health. There's a big literature, so if you like reading science, there are some good books out there to read reflecting the high level of public interest and concern in this issue. And if you like bedwetting terror more than sober science, there's actually a big body of fiction as well. The one I want to call to your attention is, I just noticed this, it's called Presidential Crisis, Ebola. This was a book that was published back when it seemed that Ebola was a bigger threat than Presidential Crisis. Well, several things drive pandemics as they break out. One is the way they emerge. The next is the way we detect, or in some cases don't detect them as they emerge. And the next is the way they spread once they've emerged. So what drives the emergence of an infectious disease outbreak? The way we live, the proximity that we as humans have with reservoirs of disease, such as animals, has changed. We are an expanding population in geographic terms. We're butting up against animals. The livestock and poultry markets of Asia are a good example. The expansion into forests are a good example. So we are up against where the infectious diseases are. Secondly, a whole range of global changes, such as climate change, change the ecology of infectious diseases and in many cases intensify our exposure and the probability of the development of these diseases. So that's the question of emergence. Once a disease emerges somewhere, and sometimes we don't even know where, how do we know that it has emerged? How do we detect it? Well, we've got several problems. Fragile health systems around the world don't make it easy. These pictures are a little bit symbolic. The picture on the left is a busy clinical facility, and you can well imagine that the providers, the doctors and nurses working in that facility, have all they can do to keep up with caring for patients, actually recording patterns of disease. Reporting new observations is often way beyond what they have the capacity to do. On the right, you see a health worker collecting data in a rural setting, writing it down on a piece of paper. That is not the surveillance system that's calculated to provide the most prompt, inaccurate, and complete data. So we often are late to the game when a disease is breaking out. The detection is often suboptimal. And finally, the spread. A number of factors contribute to the risk of a spread of disease, and two of them are shown here. The first is a graph showing the proportion of the world's population that is urban. That blue line that's rising crosses the yellow line in the past decade. The blue line is the urban population. The yellow line is the rural population. We are now a predominantly urban species. We live in close contact with each other in very densely crowded conditions, favoring the spread of diseases. On the right is a picture of one day's airplane flights around the world. And this was from 2012, about 60,000 flights per day. We're up to about 100,000 flights per day now. So the incredible transmission of people, goods, and in some cases microbes around the world contributes to the spread of diseases as well. So what are we doing about this here at UW? Well, the project, it's really more than a project. We're using the term MetaCenter. We are combining six of the different centers at UW that focus on various aspects of pandemic diseases. And the plan is to get us all coordinated in bringing the various skill sets together so that we can tackle this problem. Some specialize in infectious diseases. Some specialize in climate change and other global changes. Some specialize in capacity building and training in low and middle income countries. And bringing all these pieces together, we think, is the best way that we can orchestrate UW's contribution to the question of pandemic disease preparedness. What will we do once we get up and running? Well, there are several challenges that we think we have the capacity here to help meet on a global scale. The first challenge is disease-specific approaches. There have been polio campaigns and cholera campaigns and AIDS campaigns, but really a systems approach is needed so that we have in place the tools to tackle any pandemic disease when it arises. Secondly, we've tended to be responsive rather than anticipatory, and clearly we need the tools and systems in place so that we can anticipate and be proactive with regard to the emergence of diseases, and when they do arise, detect that promptly and act quickly. Third is the limited lead time, the fact that we often are in the midst of a bad outbreak by the time we realize it. Again, the anticipatory tools will help with that. And last, the fragmented response. You've all read stories about the response to calamities such as Zika, where dozens, if not hundreds, of NGOs and foreign governments and others are descending on a place in an uncoordinated fashion. The sophisticated systems that we need to coordinate response are very important, and that is a matter on which we think we can contribute as well. So a wide range of challenges, but a wide range of resources here at the university that we think can help. Well, we're going to move now into the three topics that Sanjay mentioned as potential pieces of this story. The first will be climate change. The second will be the transmission of diseases from animals to humans. And the third will be modeling and forecasting in a geographic context. So for the climate change piece, let me introduce Howard Frumkin, who's going to speak to you on climate change. That would be me. You're all familiar with the climate change story, despite the fact that it was evidently a Chinese confabulation designed to undermine American industry. We actually have amazingly robust data documenting this phenomenon over recent years. This is the famous picture of rising levels of carbon dioxide, due in large part to fossil fuel combustion. That, in turn, has led to a number of Earth system changes. Global temperature, surface temperature, it's risen by about 1 degree centigrade over the last century. The global average sea level, rising sea levels are a function of expanding water as the water gets warmer. Northern hemisphere snow cover, it's declining as temperatures warm. In addition to these, there are things like more frequent severe storms, drought in some areas, more rain in other areas, a whole system of interrelated, interlocking Earth system changes. And those, in turn, have a lot of implications for human health. So you'll see phenomena such as air pollution, severe weather, and extreme heat, all following directly from the geophysical changes that characterize climate change. Those, in turn, lead to a whole series of human health threats, ranging from diminished nutrition to severe heat waves. But the ones we want to talk about in the context of tonight's program are infectious diseases. Now, those fall into two major categories, diarrheal disease, cholera. These are the so-called water and food-borne diseases that typically affect people through the GI system, causing diarrheal illnesses of various kinds. The other family of infectious diseases, and the one that I'll focus on now, is the so-called vector-borne diseases, malaria, dengue, and so on, spread by vectors such as mosquitoes, ticks, flies, and so on. Now, climate change directly contributes to the spread of these diseases in a number of ways. Temperature, wind patterns, precipitation, and changes in relative humidity. All of those factors affect the biology of vectors, making, in some cases, the vectors reproduce more rapidly, feed more rapidly, and when a vector's feeding, it's biting you and me, making, in some cases, the life cycles faster so that vector biology moves toward the spread of diseases. Now, this doesn't invariably happen. Some areas actually get drier, and in those areas, the risk of disease can decrease. So we have maps of Africa where we see some areas of increasing risk, some of decreasing risk. These are the direct impacts on the spread of disease. Climate change also operates through indirect pathways. Desertification and drought, changes in vegetation, hydrologic changes, and so on. So, for example, if a river hydrology changes and the riverbank ecology changes, that can change the habitat and it can promote the growth of such vectors as tsetse flies, which can then enhance the spread of trypanosomiasis, Chagas disease, and affect more people. So many indirect ways in which climate change working through the ecosystem and through weather patterns can promote the spread of disease. Let me give you three quick examples. Dengue fever is a disease that is endemic in the Americas. The forecasts that climate modelers gave us beginning several decades ago were that dengue would spread as climate change progressed. We now have cases, endemic cases in the U.S. in Florida, Texas, and Hawaii, a new observation over just the last few years. Malaria is perhaps the vector-borne disease to which most people in the world are exposed. Very complicated disease dynamics. Many of the influencers of malaria are outside the climate change world, but climate change certainly changes malaria risk factors. In places where the weather's warmer, then malaria can expand its range, and that includes not only farther from the equator, but it also means moving up mountains. So we're seeing malaria now at elevations where it hasn't been seen before. The good news is that in some places, as rainfall drops, malaria risk is expected to decrease. The third and final example is Lyme disease. This is a tick-borne disease, and this is one that we're familiar with in this country. It began in a small area off the Long Island Sound. It has been spreading over time since then. It's up in the Midwest now and down in the South. And you can see over coming decades, the modeling predicts that it will expand considerably. It'll be one of our gifts to Canada by about 2050. And interestingly, some areas such as Florida that are currently at risk will see diminished risk as various features of climate change proceed. So a complicated story, and one that requires a lot of complicated analysis. How we use climate science in public health is we look at some of the climate models and projections that are made. This is a picture of the globe, which is divided into geographic segments. Then weather forecasts are made for each segment based on meteorologic data and other data. Then those are combined with health data, timelines showing temperatures and various diarrheal diseases, in this case in Canada. So we know something about the pattern of disease responsiveness to meteorologic factors. We forecast some of those meteorologic factors, put it together, and generate useful public health information, such as this disease may be likely to break out in this location in 20 or 30 years at the rate climate change is progressing. Let's be sure to build capacity in the laboratories for diagnosing it. Let's be sure to ramp up a surveillance system, and so on. So this is, in very quick review, the way we take climate science, merge it with public health approaches, and set out to protect the public.
That was Dr. Howard Frumkin, Professor of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington. Recorded on November 17, 2016, at a symposium under the theme, When the Next Pandemic Strikes, Are We Ready? Dr. Frumkin's comments were entitled, What Climate Change Data Can Tell Us About the Emergence and Spread of Diseases. When he gave this talk, Dr. Frumkin did not yet know that only 6 weeks later, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta would abruptly cancel a 3-day symposium on climate change, where he had been invited to speak. Breitbart News hailed the cancellation as being due to the Trump effect, where agencies are revising their position on climate change. 2 days after the CDC announced that they were canceling their climate change summit, Scientific American wrote, "The conference is now back on, but not at the CDC. The event will take place on February 16 at the nonprofit Carter Center in Atlanta." TUC Radio will follow the story. If you have any information on the upcoming event or the topic of climate change and public health, please contact us by email. The address is tuc@tucradio.org or send a letter to TUC Radio, Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418, or post to TUC Radio's Facebook page, TUC-Radio. This info is also on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And even though my health is in a rather frail situation right now, I look forward to the end of my days fighting for this new reality, knowing that I'm but one part of one generation of many, many generations that's taken humanity up to this point and must take humanity over the next set of mountains in order to fully emerge as human beings. You can smell it. You can smell it. I can, anyhow. I can smell the pastures of a new world.
That's the voice of longtime activist and radio host and journalist, Charles Borland. On this week's show, I speak to my mentor about the upcoming 2017 and the challenges and opportunities ahead in this year of resistance. So stay tuned. I am very privileged to be joined by Charles Borland. Charles Borland is a longtime social activist, a political activist, a longtime host of Wake Up with Co-op, and still does the discussion program at Co-op Radio, and he's generously given me some of his time. Good afternoon, Charles.
Good afternoon, Stuart. And let me just start by wishing all of your listeners a very successful 2017,
of resistance.
Fantastic. Well, let's, speaking of resistance, we have a very articulate and new prime minister who makes nice platitudes at the UN about climate change and about his responsibility to the future generations. And then he comes back and he approves Kinder Morgan expansion, which is going to increase our tanker traffic tenfold, while about 93% of British Columbians disagree with that decision. Where are we when it comes to this new prime minister? When are people going to kind of see through this facade that's going on?
Well, Stuart, the truth of the matter is that the financial oligarchs, which Prime Minister Justin Trudeau represents, same as the new regime in the United States, it represents very definite sections of these oligarchs, these very well powerful companies, including, as you know, ExxonMobil, which now is the foreign minister of the USA, or what they call the Secretary of State, the former CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, these elements, these cliques of individuals are in a very deep crisis because their system has exhausted itself at literally every level, Stuart. They cannot rationally plan an economy that will meet the needs of a modern society. They bump up against all the time the very private interests of particular groups. Now, you mentioned the oil question, for example, of Justin Trudeau, his decision to do the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Well, it's irrational, as you point out, from every perspective. First of all, to ship bitumen itself is a bit criminal because it's such a toxic substance that to ship it any distance in a pipe or in it by any mode of transportation doesn't make a lot of sense. Secondly, as you point out also, we need to get off these fuels and transition to a renewable energy, non-carbon energy. It's known. This is a known fact. And he, as you say, gives lip service to this. But here's the rub, Stuart. When it comes to decision-making, the other incompetence, the other block, if you will, or the other anachronism, out-of-date reality, is how decisions are made politically in the society. We know that politics really is nothing more than the concentrated economic interests of contending groups in the society. And that's what political struggle is. That's what class struggle is. So in our modern society, it's divided between, on the one hand, an enormous working class, the most disciplined, the most educated, the most trained of which are the industrial workers in large-scale, modern scientific industry, manufacturing, transportation, extraction of resources, all of these, and then all of the service areas, healthcare, education, and so on. So we have, on the one hand, this enormous body of educated, skilled working people in the society, in Canada. On the other hand, we have a very small, oligarchic, wealthy group of people, mainly linked with foreign corporations like ExxonMobil, Shell, and so on, these oil companies, and, in fact, Kinder Morgan, which is, as you know, it comes out of, what's the name of that, Enron scandal years ago, right? Mm-hmm. These big capitalists, Koch brothers and others. Now, so here's the issue. The crisis is in the political mechanisms that are designed for decision-making, and they are anachronistic. They're out of date, which means that decision-making is totally in the hands of people like Trudeau, who are directly linked to these oligarchs, who have very definite private interests on the one hand, and this huge section of society, the working class, the people who are left out of decision-making, have no practical input into the decisions that are made.
All the power lies in the Prime Minister's office. He struck a committee on democratic reform. They went around the country. Overwhelmingly, Canadians said they wanted a new system of more proportional, but he just mothballed it. So where do we go? How do we overcome the cynicism and apathy that this kind of system creates in the people?
Well, that's a very important question, Stuart. And I'm afraid The answer is a lot of very hard work on the part of activists and people who are in the resistance movement to build their own institutions. I lived from the 60s through the 70s, all the movements that were extant at that time, and Stuart, so much energy was put in to building resistance to the war in Vietnam, to all the repressive measures, to the civil rights movement, and to the National Movement for Liberation in Quebec, to the Indigenous movement in Canada, and so on and so forth. But most often than not, the energy and the work that was accomplished gave rise to no strong organization with its own aim, its own vision, and its own commitment to creating new political mechanisms for empowering the people. All these old mechanisms, I'm sorry to say, proportional representation is not going to save us. All kinds of capitalist states have proportional representation. The party system is part of the way these oligarchs rule. This is the old method. So what do we need? We need workers, groups of people who will write and discuss and organize and be on the streets and give rise to their institutions, their own media, like yourself, in the, you know, expanding the possibilities of expression and articulation of ideas, new ideas, revolutionary ideas that will take the people out of the difficult circumstance that we're in now. And these people that you, excuse me, that you mentioned, who are politicians who make false promises, this is part of the corruption of the old. And so people have to turn their attention to, okay, guys, how do we build our new own organizations and new relationships within them? Relationships based on cooperation, relationships based on freedom of conscience. Very, very important, Stuart. The freedom to think your own thoughts and articulate your own thoughts. This is a huge human right that is under direct assault by what I would call these rising fascist forces in the United States of America and around the world, who want to repress thought, who want to repress the new. And so we're in a life and death battle. And I want to interject here, if you don't mind me, Stuart, on this question of empowerment and democracy and decision making, because it touches on one of the most crucial life and death decisions facing the entire humanity. And that is the question of war versus peace. Now, many people are not putting their minds to the huge arms race, for example, which is going on right under our noses, in virtual secret, in the sense that nobody's really talking about it, except if you go on YouTube and search it out. There's an enormous arms race going off the coast of China right now between China and United States, Japan, and so on and so forth. These countries are in a life and death arms race, which will lead to war. And so the question is, in terms of doing all the other tasks that humanity has to do and solve all of the practical problems that humanity has to solve, we need time, and that means we need governments who are anti-war governments. So the question of having an anti-war Canadian government, like these environmentalists are not, in my opinion, linking sharply enough the question of control of our resources with the question of control of our foreign policy and control of our independence as a country, so that we don't have to kowtow to NATO and send 800 soldiers over to Latvia or Air Force to bomb Libya, as was done shamelessly with even the support, I have to say, of the NDP in the House of Commons. These are terrible attacks on the security of Canadians. And so the question of war and peace is very much tied in with the question of environment. Can't find anything more devastating to the environment than war. To the rights of women, you can't find anything more devastating to the rights of women than war. It's an open call for rape and brutality. And war is the greatest evil for families, children, and women. And you can't find a greater cause of impoverishment than war. You just need to look at what has happened to Libya and Iraq and to Syria. So the question of war and peace has to be a centerpiece
in creating the alternative programs, the alternative direction for the economy, for empowerment, for the people's rights and human rights. And there's no greater violation also of human rights than war, because war means fascism. War means repression of the right to think your own thoughts and to oppose war. We know how many people were repressed in wars in the past for opposing wars of their countries. So these things, Stuart, are all, if you will, interconnected. They're great movements of the people. And as I said at the opening remark, this is a year of resistance. 2017, after all, it's a centennial year of the Russian Revolution, as well as the 150th anniversary of Canada. And these two events deserve quite a lot of discussion in themselves. It's also the 50th anniversary, from my political perspective, a little pamphlet called Necessity of Change, for Change, which was written in August 1967, to the youth and students of Canada of the time and the world. Actually, the conference was held in London to discuss, okay, guys, how do we use the energy of the students of the 60s to build organization that will last? And I'm very proud to say they did give rise to a small political organization, the Communist Party of Canada, Marxist-Leninist, which is completely at the service of the working class. It has no private interest whatsoever. It has no interest in senatorial positions, in MP positions. We want to assist workers to empower themselves and to directly take control of their sectors of the economy and head in a new direction that sees the needs, the rights of all, and the needs of all are fulfilled and protected.
It's really hard to get people to a level of thinking about these critical issues. How can we break through what I would call the noise and the static? I'm taking a course now with the Vietnam era and how the government used such strong state propaganda to have the kind of evil ones and the good ones. So on a community level, how do we reach out and kind of break through this noise and infotainment?
Well, that's a very important question you're posing, Stuart. And there's nothing like talking to people, you know. One of the things our activists do, and I've done myself for many years, is knock on doors and have conversations with people. Now, usually that's limited to the short period of an election. And I have to say, we've fallen prey to that on occasion as well, more too often than not, actually. But we are making an effort now to make a systematic talking to people in neighborhoods, getting community groups together to discuss. No hidden agenda, no hidden program. What are the problems facing the people? People know, you see, one of the things, as you point out, is that there's all this noise and propaganda and diversion, let's face it, from pornography to sports. And because they don't want the people to puzzle through, think through, argue through with their brains. And thinking is hard work, you know. And to think about these issues and discuss. But when you get people talking, Stuart, they do talk. And they talk about their real life problems. And they know solutions. You talk to healthcare workers, they'll tell you what they needed in the hospital. You want a good hospital, go talk to the cleaners. They'll tell you, you want a good hospital, keep the place clean. And similarly with every sector. Steel workers know how to make steel. They love making steel. They've been trained at it. And they are fighting like hell. And in fact, the steelworkers are a very good example of a model. And I'm thinking of Local 1005 in particular in Hamilton, the Stelco workers who have been fighting this damnable, what do they call this, act where you bankruptcy. And then they go in and they fleece these companies and they steal the pensions of the workers. They destroy their livelihood. They knock down their wages and their working conditions. And you see, there the workers have begun to push forward their interests and their demands with their own organization, with their own thinking, with their own media, their leaflets, their writing, their newspapers. And yourself, like this work on the radio is so important, Stuart. It's all hard work. There's no easy road here. But when has history been easy? My parents' generation had to defeat Adolf Hitler. You think that was easy? Oh, my God. This was life and death, and especially for the people who bore the brunt of it. You know, on the Eastern Front, there are 27 million Soviet citizens lost their lives. This was life and death, but it was a huge historical advance for humanity. And every generation has to make their contribution. If our generation and our children's generation and grandchildren's generations can at least stop the war, stop imperialist war, elect or create some anti-war governments by their actions, this would be an historical contribution of immense proportions. So the answer to your question is, work hard to build your own institutions and organizations, your newspapers, your radio stations, your political discussion groups, neighborhood discussion groups. Why not get out and meet the neighbors? Much of Vancouver, as you know, is very ghettoized. We have people from many nationalities living here. We don't know each other very well. The other day, I'll just tell you a tiny little anecdote. I was sitting in the cancer ward. I have an illness. And I was sitting next to a Palestinian woman who started weeping because her husband had cancer and he had rather bad news, you know. And I put my hand on her arm and I said, now, my sister, what's wrong? What's the problem? And we started a wonderful conversation. We talked about Palestine. We talked about Canada. We talked about the struggle for justice, the fight for the rights of all. And we were like brothers and sisters, you know, like brothers and sisters. We're people from opposite ends of the earth, for goodness sakes. Different language back. Fortunately, she spoke English because I certainly don't speak Arabic. But you know, Stuart, social love that binds us together as fellow human beings, irrespective of our nationality, our language, our religious beliefs, our personal beliefs. But we have common problems to solve, whether it be healthcare or stopping a war. And this requires the empowerment of the people to be the decision makers. So often you hear, oh, well, we have to go to the decision makers and ask, you know, persuade the decision makers not to have Kinder Morgan. Excuse me? The decision maker is Kinder Morgan. Oh, Lord the Christ, are we joking? What are we, what kind of farce is this? They are the decision makers. They make the goddamn decisions. They ram them down our throats. And here's the thing, Stuart. Because they're so bankrupt and because they're in such deep crisis, they don't have government of laws anymore. They do not have government of laws. What they have is government of police powers. Because the day that government says Kinder Morgan is going through and you start really resisting it, or the peace dam is going through and you really start resisting, you say, no, the people of British Columbia are not going to have that river stolen away from us. And they act, well, guess what? They're going to call the RCMP. They're going to call the armed forces. They even said that we'll call the armed forces if people get, you know, strong and active. But Canadians have got to wake up. I mean, are we going to become a people? Are we going to become a force in the world that people can respect? And say, oh, yeah, those Canadians are very nice, but they also fight. And I have great faith in the American working class that they will rise up and fight. But they've got miles to go. We have miles to go. The people of the world have miles to go. But we are all connected as human beings. And I'm quite persuaded that we will get through this crisis. But only with effort, Stuart. It's not going to come easy. Sacrifice and hard work. So if you're looking for an easy way, you know, what can I tell you? You know, there's the Super Bowl game. It'll be already played out by the time you're broadcasting. But there you have diversion of diversions, right? Two billionaire football clubs fighting it over advertising revenue. Jesus Christ, the whole world's going to hell in a basket. Spending billions of dollars on armaments. Haven't got enough money to get the homeless people off the street. You know, come on. What's going on here? We can turn this around, but it will take work. And you know what? There's a slogan that says, I don't want a revolution if it doesn't have dancing in it or something like that. It's a joy, you know, working for a new life, working for a new world. It's a great joy. I've had decades at it, Stuart. And even though my health is in a rather frail situation right now, I look forward to the end of my days fighting for this new reality, knowing that I'm but one part of one generation of many, many generations that's taken humanity up to this point. and must take humanity over the next set of mountains in order to fully emerge as human beings. You can smell it. You can smell it. I can, anyhow. I can smell the pastures of a new world and the creation of the working class and peoples to build really something you could call humane, human, based on love, on solidarity, and eliminating greed and racism and chauvinism and all this. This male egotism, military bullshit. We want a new and better life, and we will get it with hard work and hard struggle, Stuart. Absolutely.
If we rely on the professionals, these are the people who brought our environment to collapse. If we rely on the professional class, they're the ones who pushed us through that financial crisis. And as you mentioned, the terrible inequality, homelessness. This is the professional class. It's the working class that lifts us up and that always has. And I know you've been involved for years and you've touched on it a little bit, but why? Why, Charles? Why do you fight? What is the kind of the engine behind your activism?
Well, thanks, Stuart. That's a nice question to end off with, because it comes precisely from the struggle of the working class that I was born into. My father was of Irish descent in Liverpool, went to sea at age 15, was a non-educated, you can say wage slave, you know, like those guys shoveling coal into the Titanic in the movie. That's what he did for a living. Then he jumped ship in the United States and he became an organizer of seamen, was one of the founding organizers of the National Maritime Union in 1937 in the United States of America. And they fought, you know, organized throughout the war. And my mother was similarly. She came from a poor, her parents were shopkeepers in an African-American ghetto in Louisville, Kentucky. I found out that's the hometown of my hero, Muhammad Ali. Anyhow, she came from that environment. And they joined the communist movement because in those days, the Soviet Union was a rising power. It was doing the five-year plans and so on, so they had hope. They didn't have a lot of education, but they had militancy and communism. But that got betrayed. And unfortunately, we had to live through that betrayal of the Soviet Union, the collapse of it, and the people responsible for it, the Khrushchevs and the Brezhnevs and these other gangsters. Unfortunately, that was a huge loss, no question about it. But the fighting spirit of my parents' generation, and especially their passion to defeat Hitler in the United Front against fascism in World War II, that has been the fuel of my fiery determination to participate. My father raised me with this slogan: never desert the working class. Stick with the workers. Now, does that mean the intellectuals and the artists and so on don't have a role to play? Of course, they have a huge role to play. Look at Paul Robeson, giant of a man. Now, he's a minority, but he stood up with the workers. And this is the key. He was with the Welsh miners. He was with the English working class. He was with the workers of the United States. And he was a great artist, intellectual. Others have been in the movement as well. The communists, the Curries, the famous atomic scientists, they were progressive people. Many, many people joined. But here's the thing. That strata of society doesn't usually come into action unless the workers are organized, unless the workers are in motion. And they were in the 30s, and they were in the 40s, Stuart, and they were in the 50s. And that's the movement that the workers need to get going again, get that engine going again. It will attract the best of the intellectuals. It will attract the best of the academics to its side. Always there will be those looking for the six-digit income, you know, things and so on. But hey, and then once the workers have empowered themselves and they are the decision makers, they'll ensure that the sons and daughters of all the ordinary people on the earth get the best possible education so they can join that intellectual strata, but as part of a movement of the entire society to lift the material and cultural well-being of everybody in it.
Any final thoughts about the year ahead, what's coming up, what to expect?
Well, yes, from the perspective of those of us who are in the resistance movement and are building various things, My party has started a project now to build a national office in Ottawa. We're very proud of that because, you know, we give a call. We say, well, workers need their own independent organizations. Well, you're not much of an organization if you don't have your own independent organization and your, you know, your office and your and so on. We have a big project to get that going, and also we've been organizing discussion groups. And we give a call to all the activists, brothers and sisters, sisters and brothers, let's stay together, unite together, discuss things, debate things, but keep our right to our thoughts and our capacity to articulate our conscience. Don't suppress people because they're communists. Don't suppress people because they're Muslim. Don't suppress people because of this or that excuse. In building our movement, it has to be a movement that is profoundly democratic and based on a social love for the society to move it forward. And that's a way we will change ourselves as well, Stuart, in all of this.
Thank you so much, Charles, for being so generous all these years and always making yourself available. And even in your little under the weather, you're still doing it. And I think it's a brilliant idea to have like an intellectual headquarters where people can go there and experience different ideas and pivot from that place. So thank you so much for doing this, and we'll speak again soon.
Well, you're very welcome, Stuart, and I'll conclude with what I said at the very beginning. Listeners, please make this 2017 a great year of resistance. Let's go all out. Let's have success. Let's build on our work. And a new world is possible. It can be done, and it will be done. It must be done. Thank you.
So, Charles, how can people find more information about your work and your activities?
Well, thanks for asking me that, Stuart. Yes, if you go to cpcml.ca, www.cpcml.ca, that stands for the Communist Party of Canada, Marxist-Leninist, there's a very lively, ongoing set of journals for the workers' movement, for the issue of democracy, and for general political matters. I'm sure that many of your listeners will find it of interest.
Thank you so much, Charles. We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.